as you see that what appear is if my own watch coincides with that here in Good Hope Chambers, is now 10 o'clock. So we do have a very long program ahead of us today, and we do want to ensure that it goes smoothly. So we would want those who are coming in after Cassata, do you all have a program? Because if you do, then you know who's coming afterwards. Let's not have any time delays. It would appear, members, as if we all have the documents. Is that correct? Has every member got the documents? Good. And then, on that note, if we can have someone to propose the adoption of this agenda, please, one of the committee members. Honourable Williams, seconded by, I never know, just as well the ANC is here, because no other party ever wants to, second an agenda. Thank you, Honourable Quinoff. On that note, let's get the apologies. I have one written apology, and that is the Honourable Mantashe, who we do hope she will recover soon, and we'll keep a track on her medical improvement. She's in hospital, so we need to keep that on board. I also have been informed that the Black Sash will be joining us later. They are going to be bringing with them their presentation. We have a request from Cassata too, because they are attending another meeting, if they could please be released immediately after making the presentation. So that being the case, we will certainly allow it, because as you can see, while we will allow some clarification here and there, if there's any need for clarification from yourselves, Cassata, we'll put that in writing to you. So just give me the time to go down to the main floor here, where I will continue chairing from. Thank you. And as soon as I am seated, you will be able to go ahead, Cassata. Right, so we now have, I know that it's Matthews, is it? I shouldn't just be saying that, but I don't have the list in front of me. Let's just see who we do have here, officially your name. No, don't worry. Can you give us your full name? I mean, we should have that right in front of me, but it's not here. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Chairperson. Good morning, Chair and members, and colleagues from, I guess I could say, Capital is here in full force today. I seem to be the lone voice from the left, but okay. No, thanks very much, Chair. My name is Matthew. My surname is Parks. I'm from the Congress of South African Trade Unions. So I think we want to thank the committee for giving us space today to share two cents of thought on this very important issue. Hopefully we can add some value to what is a very progressive and critical initiative by the committee. I think Chairperson would also want to appreciate the work this committee does, in particular above other committees, around trying to protect the ordinary person on the street. We've done quite a few good progressive amendments to the laws over the past 5 years and before. Those really have helped, and we would wish to see all committees and all departments of government having the same fighting spirit, Chairperson. Chair, look, I know this is a fairly new territory the committee is kind of engaging on. In my limited memory, I can't recall another committee developing its own bill in the last 22 years. I could be wrong, but nonetheless, it's a very welcome initiative. I think as COSATU, we really share the committee's concerns around the high levels of indebtedness in the country. And of course, our premise economically is the triple challenges we are still burdened with, one of the three being unemployed, us unfortunately being world leaders in poverty and inequality. I think, Chair, also we're deeply saddened by the rising levels of unemployment. We've seen numerous retrenchments taking place this year in the mining sector, the retail sector, even the banking sector, and so on. And I think, Chair, we all know the issues of our jobless economic growth and our low growth rates, which of course are not unique to us alone, unfortunately.
Right, just a minute. I've now been given the list of stakeholders, and it's Mr. M. Parks, Matthew Parks, all right. Thank you very much, Mr. Parks. So we will then be easier to be more courteous. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chair. Chair, we try to, whilst looking at the committee's mandate and so on, to look at how can we assist with coming up useful suggestions to the committee. I think, Chair, having said, we also are mindful that this DTI and the committee have made quite a few amendments to the credit laws in the past few years, very progressive laws. Of course, one of our key frustrations is the challenge around enforcing those laws on the ground. And I think Marikana, unfortunately, is a very painful warning sign to all of us what happens when we don't enforce credit laws sufficiently on the ground. I think, Chair, you don't even need to go to Marikana. You can just walk out in Cape Town, and you can find all sorts of loan sharks, which one is sure I've never seen DTI, sadly, on enforcing the regulations on it. Chair, we're also trying to look at finding some remaining gaps in the existing laws based upon feedback we received from our members, as COSATU. And I think lastly, Chair, we're trying to come up with some ideas around possible debt relief for the most vulnerable. So, Chair, look, I think we would all love to see debt relief. But I think we're not so naive and idealistic to expect a complete debt write-off. So we really tried to look at who are the most vulnerable categories that were, the committee will be able to look at legally, that there are legal definitions for these categories, but also financially they're not coping with all the high levels of debt. So I think the first category we looked at is retrenched workers. You've seen the mining sector this year, we lost about 52,000 jobs. F&B, I think, retrenched about 700 staff earlier this year. Joshua Dorr also retrenched about 10,000 staff earlier this year. So we can see the economy is bleeding across the field. Many of your loans nowadays do have retrenchment insurance for the loans. But I think, unfortunately, it's still voluntary. And that's just it's a new phenomenon. Most loans won't have that retrenchment policy. So I think that's one area to look at, making retrenchment policy compulsory and more affordable. I think, Chair, obviously, we should look at the issue of social grant recipients because obviously they earn barely enough money to survive. And I think we know that there's been problems around people deducting money from social grants, bank accounts, and so on. Chair, also, your municipalities also do good work around providing for indigent households. I think another category we could look at. And then, of course, Chair, your persons who earn below this the income tax threshold can be another category we could look at easily. So trying to give kind of easily legally that definable constituency to target. Chair, I think also, given the crisis facing the university students, both working class, middle class families, who are simply not able to afford student loans of 120,000 or 60,000 a year, clearly that's also a category we need to look at. Chair, the last two categories we want to push for is that you often have families who have a home loan or a car loan or even a small business or a farm loan. They've paid off maybe 3/4 of the loan, but now because they're retrenched or because of a family tragedy, they go into default. And then often what happens, the bank then repossesses that property and sells it for a fraction of what the person already paid back on the loan and for a fraction of the value. So here, and what happens then, you have a family which is left destitute, out of the house, because they didn't pay for 6 months or a year, though they had paid for 15 years. I think, Chair, we need to do something about this. And of course, those very same families are then blacklisted. They cannot then get another home loan in the future. And the same would apply for cars, for small businesses, and I think even for farms as well. Chair, we're not saying people mustn't pay the loans, but there must be some kind of an appeal mechanism. If I default for 6 months because of a genuine tragedy, I'm able to go and engage with the bank. They're able to look at extending the period, giving me a small holiday, revisiting their charges, etc. I think the last category, Chair, would want to push for is for victims of reckless lending or criminal exploitation. Chair, we think that people have really been exploited through this extremely reckless lending or pure naked exploitation should be eligible for some form of debt cancellation. And if it's criminal lending, even reimbursement. Chair, in terms of your legally compliant lending, again, I think there must be some kind of mechanism. If a person or a family or small business is not coping, they should be able to go to the lender and appeal for an extension of the term or reduced interest charges or bank charges and even possibly holidays, etc. And we think that kind of appeal mechanism should be inbuilt within the lender but also within your credit legislation and your oversight bodies. Chair, yeah, as we mentioned earlier, student debt clearly is a challenge and we need to revisit that. And again, I think, Chair, I've already touched upon the issue of homes, cars, small businesses and farms. I think, Chair, one issue which needs special attention from the committee and the department and the credit authorities is the issue of auctions. Often we've heard from our members who've lost their homes or even from our banking affiliate, SASCO, is that you do have certain corrupt individuals in the lending or banking institutions who see someone as buckling, they can't pay their home, they then fast-track it to be repossessed. They have a friend outside who then bids for that house, which is sold on the auctioneer for a fraction of the price. 3 months later, they flip the house and they sell it for a profit. Mm-hmm. We know that's obviously it's not an official policy, but there are corrupt officials who are really acting like vultures. And we think they need special effort around that area in particular. And we're hoping our colleagues in the banking sector would be able to help us in that regard especially. Chair, I think also... There's the issue of the interest rates, and we know the Reserve Bank will always say they target the issue of inflation, which is fine, but I think also because banks link their interest rates to the Reserve Bank, their mandate should be expanded to also look at affordability. Because every time Donald Trump does something crazy, or the US, whatever happens, or Iraq, our interest rates jump for reasons beyond our control, and the immediate effect is to further impoverish consumers and to further depress the economy. And surely that should also be a key mandate, as well as managing inflation. Chair, look, we do think the existing laws are fairly progressive, but again, it's the issue of enforcement. And we're not convinced that the majority of your lenders are being policed and managed properly through the system. We think that loan shark system should simply be put out of business. They're nothing less than vultures who are really exploiting the desperation of our people. But having said that, Chair, we must also look at the banks. The banks must become more accessible, more affordable, so that people who are desperate don't go to the loan shark. If banks are affordable and accessible, then I think people would rather go there than to the loan sharks. I think, Chair, it's also worrying that there is one major commercial bank which owns a separate money lender, which is a halfway point between the commercial banks and the loan sharks. So if you go to this bank and you deny the application, you will then go to this major money lender, which charges you a 25% interest rate, for example. But they're much less strict upon the criteria to get the loan approved, so people go to it. But surely it can't be right that I deny you interest here at the bank, and I've got a company here which will then receive you at triple the charge. Chair, I think also our colleagues from business always tell us about competition will reduce prices. But we've yet to see that with bank charges. In fact, what we've seen is to us looks like anti-competitive behavior and collusion, and really think that needs to be addressed. I think lastly, the point here, Chair, also that we'd want it for the banks to see themselves as partners to to the rest of society, and they should look at reducing bank charges. Some of them are really exorbitant. I think, Chair, would be remiss as COSATU not to raise the issue of retention in the banking sector over this year and over the past few years. And then lastly, Chair, banks are not just private companies, but they make their money from consumers' bank charges and interest rates and so on. Yet we have a massive wage gap in the banking sector. You have a CEO earning 30 million rand a year, but bank tellers earning 200,000 rand a year. But again, we've seen in FNB alone this year, I think about 700 banking staff being retrenched in Eastern Cape and Gauteng. FNB, yeah. I could be wrong, but that's what we were told by staff. I think lastly, Chair, government has often talked about creating a state bank, and perhaps this is an ideal opportunity to revive the whole post-bank idea. It could be a more affordable and accessible bank targeting the poor and the rural areas and help to take people away from the loan sharks. Chair, look, we also, in addition to engaging our unions for the submission, we did talk to Stellenbosch Legal Aid Clinic, which has done quite fantastic work in the past year, I think everybody will be aware of. I think their main issue is about how do we increase education amongst consumers, bank officials, court officials, and also human resource officials. Often, most people are not aware of the laws and the requirements and how garnish orders can be administered and so on. So that's basically it in a nutshell, Chair. We hope this suggestion makes some helpful to the committee. We would be available to help the committee in future on any further work as well. I think we do appreciate the committee's taking this progressive and badly needed initiative. I think we also want to plead, Chair, with about the urgency of now, because too often Parliament, because of the schedule, because of how government works, takes too long to pass bills. They take years, 2 years. Not saying it must take 2 minutes to get in trouble with the Constitutional Court, but at least we want to see a bit of urgency, because such a progressive idea as this one could really help consumers and the economy at large. So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell, Chair, and hopefully the members. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parks, for the COSATU presentation. Yes, we do think this is an important initiative, and not simply important. It is essential, given the current environment in the country, but we know it's not sufficient. So we have every intention of not delaying the progress of the measures we put forward in this regard. But we are going to need to work with not only the civil society, which includes the unions as well, but also we are going to need to work with private sector itself and the public sector. We all have a direct participation in this, and it is essential that we address the situation jointly in partnership. We will be keeping you posted, Mr. Parks, COSATU, through yourself, because we will want you to perhaps re-engage with us during the progress of this. It may in fact be again this month, and of course it will continue early next year as well. But thank you very much indeed. And you are excused as already requested. Thank you. I also want to take the opportunity of... I was looking for the DTI DDG, Mr. Nyetse Tenzi, but for the life of me, I couldn't see him anywhere. Where is he, Ms. Naidu?
There's an accident on the M1, and he's a bit delayed. He's on his way.
Right. I am aware that the accident has been cleared. Perhaps you can inform him. That's why our members are here. Right. But anyway, that's the reason. But we also have with us here I thought I saw Ms. Nomsa Motshikari, but perhaps I didn't. And then I do see here we're expecting Mr. Sipa Mangla, Director, CCRD. Thank you. Mr. K. Mahotsi, CCRD as well. The CCRD is Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division, right? And who else have I missed out? Oh, yes, Ms. Matsugari, the Chief Executive Officer. All right, just didn't see you there. And Mr. Masharpa, the Company Secretary, also of the National Credit Regulator. While they're all setting up, you will recall that when the global economy was going to the wall and countries were just collapsing left, right and centre, the World Bank and the IMF pointed to the fact that it was our National Credit Regulation Act, the NCR, that saved South Africa, one of the critical instruments that saved South Africa. And we expect again to use this area to also address the issues that are leading to serious challenges in the economy and to our people in this country. On that particular note, let us take our next stakeholder, and that is an input from the Chamber of Mines of South Africa. And is that Ms. Sue Fritz, Deputy Head Legal?
That is correct, Chair.
And I see a colleague alongside you who doesn't look like a robot.
No, this is Zakiti, Ms. Zakiti Zama from our chamber, and she's just here to assist me with the presentation.
He is your co-worker here today.
She's a member of the team, yes.
And so she's a team member, right, thank you. On that note, can we allow you to address us?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Members, the Chamber is very grateful to be included in this invitation to present to you, and particularly to comment on the debt relief proposal. What we'd like to do is to also share with you a brief overview of the success that the Chamber has achieved to date on its indebtedness programs, working in conjunction with all stakeholders. So what we did is we have engaged with the unions, and the unions have been fully on board in respect of the programs that we've initiated. I would just like to upfront apologize to you that later on there's just a change in one slide, so your numbering is slightly different. I will send the correct pack to you. But if I could start by also thanking the National Credit Regulator for the investigation into debt relief and the report issued in April 2015. The Chamber has also noted the progress report on the debt forgiveness program presented to the Portfolio Committee on the 18th of October. Insofar as the industry's success is concerned, we established a task team to investigate employee indebtedness in 2013. We identified it as a key risk to the labour relations in the industry and also was a key factor in the salary increases claimed by unions. As you will recall, shortly after and around the Marikana incident, the claims for wage increases were significantly raised. The percentage was raised. We saw that over-indebtedness was also leading to employee turnover, and we were losing skills, key skills. There was increased levels of absenteeism and presenteeism, low employee morale. There was healthcare problems caused mainly due to the stress of the situation, and increased levels of fraud, theft, and on-the-job accidents. It's important to note that there's definitely a link between operational safety and the indebtedness of an employee. As you know, indebtedness was identified as one of the key catalysts in the 2012 platinum strike action and the Marikana tragedy. The task here, I'll just take some highlights here, that we needed, the key thing once we did an audit was to identify the financial literacy of employees and the management of emolument attachment orders as a key function that had to be attended to. The emolument attachment orders are the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of further work that needs to be done, and the priority in respect of the employee indebtedness orders was to try and reschedule the debt so that it was at least 50% of the employee's income. Unfortunately, we had incidents where there was a zero income on some employees' wage slips because of debt, and that was a very significant problem. We also engaged with a number of stakeholders such as Treasury, the National Credit Regulator and others to request legislative changes, and the Chamber also reports on this matter to the Presidential Framework for Sustainable Mining Industry Task Team. So now if I could just try and just briefly run through some of the initiatives which you see on page 4. The auditing and managing of the EOs were conducted by a number of outsourced service providers such as DCM or Summit. There were also a number of individuals with experience who were asked to provide financial literacy training. A number of actions were taken against credit providers in respect of reckless lending and or incorrect interest rates. The administrators, we went against some administrators as well. There are court actions pending in respect of them. Where necessary, we sent employees to engage in the debt management process. There was a lot of industrial theatre which highlighted debt consolidation and home ownership. Extensive communication campaign. A concerted effort to remove micro-lenders from mine property. They were identified as a key issue. And their interest rates, as you know, could be 60% upwards. We also engaged in retirement planning workshops, and this is important because a number of the employees who are members of the Mine Workers Provident Fund, and the Mine Workers Provident Fund also conducted a study of the level of indebtedness amongst its members. Understandably, their function is to make sure that as much of the retirement savings of the individual as possible will be paid upon that individual's retirement. And their figures were alarming and matched many of the employers' figures. So we are now working very closely with the Mine Workers Provident Fund to try and address the situation. There's also been a lot of legislative reform which we lobbied for, and we are very thankful that legislation has been passed. We believe that also many of the irregularities or important problems relating to indebtedness have been addressed by both legislative reform and by certainly the employers in the mining industry, such as, we give examples, the lack of basic financial and legal literacy skills. It's a long-term solution, but we are achieving tremendous success. More than 60% of the entire workforce has been trained in financial literacy, and we've noticed a considerable improvement in the understanding by employees of debt and what to look for when lenders are offering them debt. The irregularities on the part of creditors, such as the consent to judgments, interest rates, the bribery of the clerks of the court, inflating debts, a lot of that has been changed, and lack of knowledge by employers. We also realized that a number of the people in the human resources and payroll departments didn't really understand the emoluments attachment order. So a concerted effort has been made by employers to make sure that these individuals were well indicated and they could go through. There was a checklist developed by the Chamber, look out for, and that has been very successful. The affordability assessments, we have found that legislative reform has been a tremendous help, and we encourage such further amendments. So we believe that the legislation, for the most part, is effective. Like Kasatu has mentioned, we must focus on enforcing the law. We do think we need to apply some effort to enforce it. The debt counselling, we're not so sure that has been a very successful process. But we are of the view that if we can concentrate on the reckless lending and enforcement, we might well do away with the debt counselling provision. We believe there's a lot of scope for the National Credit Regulator to be more effective in respect of reckless lending and affordability assessment. We've noted the proposal to enhance the National Credit Regulator's powers and that the reckless loans provisions be extended to retrenched mine workers and that a once-off debt forgiveness program be initiated. In principle, we are supportive of this, but we'd like to look at the detail. Insofar as debt relief, we really welcome the Stellenbosch legal aid success in the Constitutional Court on the 13th of September, as it addressed fundamental issues facing the mining industry, such as the fact that it's vitally important that a magistrate review these judgments, Section 65J judgment orders, and that the magistrate be satisfied that it is just and equitable that the EAO be issued and that the monthly amounts to be deducted from the debtor's salary are appropriate. And we also, the other key factor we were very pleased that was addressed is that the consent to the jurisdiction of a magistrate's court other than one where the employee lives or works or where the goods are accepted was absolutely important. We had workers in Rustenburg who were requested to sign these consent to the jurisdiction of a magistrate court, and you'd find the Kempton Park Court issuing the EAO. Very odd, not acceptable. So as we say, this decision is welcome and will have profound implications and will deal with unscrupulous providers. The successes we've managed to achieve, because it has been a joint collaboration with the union, it's amazing the trust that has been built up, particularly by the fact that the employers have demonstrated that their ability to deal with unscrupulous credit providers. The interventions were launched together with all stakeholders at each site. The number of EAOs have decreased significantly, in some cases at some operations by as much as 60%. As I mentioned, more than 60% of the workforce have been provided with financial literacy training. Insofar as the auditing of the emolument attachment orders are concerned, there have been huge savings for the employees where invalid EAOs have been identified. In many instances, there have been savings over 400,000 rand. At Sabania, as part of their Care for Mali intervention, more than 862,000 rand was saved. Anglo Platinum, the number of EAOs that were reduced from 6,000 in March 2011 to 1,204 in August 2016.
Chosen to do some construction repairs at this time, thank you, but please let's make an attempt to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we also have a home, the industry also is encouraging home ownership, and it's quite interesting that through the initiatives of the mining industry, a lot more employees have become eligible for home loans. There has also been evidence of good debt management by employees, and we also have had a great deal of success with brand ambassadors, calling them, telling the good story. I've just raised a few potential remedies which we've spoken about with some stakeholders and which we've come across. We've also engaged with a training executive with a psychology background, and we have said that the most important thing is to determine the root cause of employee indebtedness going forward, because it's a long-term solution, but we need short-term answers as well. The current, the most important is the what is driving the demand for debt. We certainly agree with Kasatu that the rising levels of unemployment in South Africa and the current economic low growth scenario is cause for concern. The other one is the once-off emergency expenses where individuals have to pay for funerals or medical expenses, and then there's also the societal pressure. We do believe it's important that the employers share the results of their audits with the NCR, and we encourage a list of the unscrupulous creditors to be compiled. We have identified that where we've made savings on the EOA, another area that has to be addressed is some of the employees are taking those savings, so to speak, that extra income in their monthly paycheck, and they've now gone, some of them, and got these payday loans and the short-term loans. And that's another area that we are going to have to tackle. It's like that bubble in the pipe. We've addressed this and we've noted there's an increase there. So we need to sort that one out. The debt review process that I referred to in paragraph 4 on that page, we believe that we need to consider that issue because it's not necessarily successful. A lot of people don't do it. The once-off set-off of debts from retirement fund benefits with a penalty of not being able to access a loan for a further 6 months, this has got some media coverage and has been proposed by a service provider. The Chamber of Mines does not support this, not only because it is currently not possible in terms of the law, but because the Chamber supports the Treasury initiative relating to retirement reform and the emphasis on savings. The very important thing that the Chamber supports and would like to encourage is that we develop some system of real-time data sharing so that lenders can access, so those that provide valid loans can access the exact debt status of the person applying for the loan. And also the regulator can also get an idea of who are the good guys, and what is the actual extent of people's loans? What are they all payday loans? What is going on? So we would really like a system of real-time data to be developed, and we need to work together to support that. I think that the service provider's culture has been changed through court decisions, and the reports by the media on scrupulous lending practices. Just as mention is made in the NCR report of the United Kingdom, USA and Australia, where there's the naming and shaming approach, just as it's worked there, I think it's working in South Africa. And once again, we encourage it, the Chamber encourages it. And we understand there are a number of court cases in the pipeline, so hopefully we will achieve some further results. Debt relief for targeted individuals is a potential remedy as proposed. We think this is in principle, a very good idea, as long as it's, as you say, targeted. It's the poor individuals. They valid loans. We would like to see it subject perhaps to criteria similar to the New Zealand, England and Wales NINA program, No Income, No Assets, where there are various thresholds in relation to liabilities, income and assets. If we could go to the next one, the viable debt relief number one. Sorry, so that was the old page 7. Sorry, if we can go back to that, which is the first one. That's where I have the... we've noted the shortcomings of the existing debt relief options and the intention to amend the National Credit Act to effect debt forgiveness as a once-off measure. We haven't had sight of these amendments. We'd like to work together on these. We're not in a position to comment at this stage, but we do think emphasis must be placed on reckless lending, payday and short-term loans. The legal and other challenges that may arise in the implementation, What we want to caution that it's very important that we look at or be cognizant of the unintended consequences in determining the most appropriate relief, given that previous debt amnesties have not worked or not changed the behaviour of any individual. So we really need to be very careful how we apply this, that we don't encourage a culture of acquiring more debt. You know, that it's a once-off debt and there's a consequent learning from the progress. You know, if a valid debt is obtained, we believe there's a responsibility to pay it and the debt must be enforceable. However, we do believe that in the where circumstances have changed, as you are talking about in your proposal, there could be a rescheduling of debt. As again, in the third bullet point, vital that valid loans are enforceable and that we give effect to the collection of loans. We must never undermine the rule of law or the provisions of the Constitution which relate to the right to credit. We must be careful the granting of debt relief could impact on the Treasury and government's message to save, but we believe that if the debt proposal should be acceptable given the targeting, specific targeting according to specific criteria. We are concerned that any proposed debt relief or wiping off of debt could result in the cost of credit rising. And in this regard, we take cognizance of the World Bank report of the Indian example, what happened with their debt relief program as reported in your program. The criteria that should inform debt relief measures, the target group of debtors, we see that there's a suggestion that retrenched workers in the mining and steel sections be included. In principle, we are supportive of this program, but we'd like to engage on just how we affect it. As I say, we need more information. I need to get a mandate as well. I'm not mandated to comment on this. The student loan forgiveness program, again, we look, in principle, we support it. We've noted the loan forgiveness programs in the USA, and just to let you know, there is a tremendous amount of work. As you know, we had students and unions marching on the chamber, and the head of skills development of the chamber is engaging with various stakeholders, and there's a tremendous amount of work being done on how we can deal with student loans, the funding of VASP, etc. I will share that with you should the need arise in further engagement. Our counselling one, we agree, is a costly mechanism. Once again, we like the no income, no assets debt relief proposed in New Zealand, England and Wales, where there's a change in circumstances rather than excessive borrowing. You know, that those cases are worthy of consideration. We like the carrot and stick approach here because it's nice to give but also to ensure that it's not taken advantage of. As to your B proposals, we've noted the USA loan forgiveness programs, and we believe these should be informed. The type and amount should be informed by what is proposed overseas. Insofar as retrenchments, again, we look at the criteria of MENA, New Zealand, England and Wales. And we need some more information in the manner in which the debt relief measures will be effected. But in the next one, if I can go, what I wanted to... Number four, possible impact should the measures be implemented. I can only comment in respect of the economic impact of the EOOs that was dealt with in terms of the 2013 econometrics study, and they found that no repayment or slow repayment of debt was costing the economy about 9.7 billion and 72,800 jobs. 30% of debts are recovered through EOA, so you know, where's that other 70%? If they are banned and the money not collected, the negative effect on the GDP, they said, would be between 1.4 billion and 3.2 billion, significant sum, and that the average interest rate increase could be 0.25%, and it could be job losses in the region, sorry, there's a spelling, of 24,000. If there was non-payment of debt by 35% of all over indebted debtors, you could look at 19.6 billion in total and an average interest rate increase of 1.3%. So the Chamber is not able to comment on the economic impact of debt relief measures at this stage, but we would have to take into consideration the World Bank study on the India's program and try and avoid those consequences. And I would like to thank you for the time granted to us, and we would like to engage with you further if we can be of any assistance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fritz. And certainly the points you've made, I'm sure, will be taken into account, not only by all the members here, but I should have mentioned earlier, we've established a subcommittee, which we often do when we're taking on these complex issues. Now, the subcommittee is chaired by Mr. Williams, the Honourable Williams, sitting there. You can raise his hand so you can identify him. And I think members of that subcommittee, if I'm not mistaken, on my right, it's yourself, isn't it, Honourable Hill Lewis? And who else is it, Honourable Williams? Honourable Mantashe, who unfortunately is ill. Who else is it? Honourable Albert, sitting just behind me here. Is that right? Thank you very much. Also, so we have a member missing at the moment, and perhaps we'll be able to get the Honourable Mkongi or yourself, Honourable Van Skulpvaak, assisting in that until the return of Honourable Mantashe. But just to let you know, now it would appear as if Kasatu were also very eager to engage us, notwithstanding their other commitment. So what we'll do is immediately just engage with yourself, and if that's still in line with your timing, and then with Kasatu. So members, I would appreciate it if you would raise your hands. Honourable Mkongi, who else? Raise your hands, because I can't see you by just a gesture any longer. Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Albert. Yes, comment, question. Yes, Honourable Esther Hayton. Now, in that order, if you take Honourable Kurnal, a couple of minutes each, members, I would suggest you avoid the preambles. Leave that for the House. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Firstly, I would like to welcome both presentations from the Congress of South African Trade Unions and the Chamber of Mines. But I wanted to begin this discussion with a quote to say what we are doing here today, we are following an international trend. I just want to give you one quote. In September 2016, the joint IMF and World Bank comprehensive approach to debt reduction was designed to ensure that no poor country faces a debt burden it cannot manage. Now, this speaks to the heart of indebtedness of South African households, especially the poor. Now, it becomes the moral responsibility and ethical responsibility of any nation to intervene and save the poor, the vulnerable, and the downtrodden. So this initiative talks to the heart of humanity and brotherhood in the Republic of South Africa. It's the call for a social pact among South Africans to save for the poor. So if we have that moral obligation of understanding the material conditions of the poor, therefore this initiative should be welcomed by all. It should be welcomed by all because it is part of the constitution of the Republic of South Africa that the state should intervene and be in the sight of the poor. There are fundamental issues that COSAT is raising, which are supposed to be taken very seriously. One, the relationship between the repo rate and the interest rate, it is fundamental. Because the reserve banks put up a repo rate, but consumers are the ones who accept that interest, and the bank shifts that to the poor, and the people are paying serious high interest rates in terms of the bonds and their own cars. So we need to look seriously on this matter of the relationship between the repo rate. The second one, Chairperson, we need a resolution to wipe out loan sharks. Why do we have loan sharks? It should be criminal. Because the loan sharks, if you take 50 rand, you pay 50 rand 100%. And it is geared to the poor. So those two, for me, are very fundamental as an introduction to the matter. Thank you very much.
Very much. Judging from your comment and questions, members may need 2.5 minutes because, Honourable Mkongi, you took 4 minutes. Right. But there we are. I didn't keep my list with me, but you know who's next. Was that the... Who was next? Wait. Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much. Mr. Parks, I see you're still here. Does that mean that we can ask questions to you? Or? Okay, great. You're back now. All right. So two quick questions to the Chamber of Mines then. I want to try and make the discussion as clear as possible because it can get very fuzzy and very wide-ranging very quickly. So the first thing is when your members lay off workers, and there have been many thousands of layoffs, very sadly, in the last year or so, do they inform them about their rights in terms of the credit life insurance agreement that they have on their loans? Because it has been reported to us in this committee that many of the people that have been laid off took voluntary retrenchment packages, which does not entitle them to claim their coverage in terms of their credit life insurance on their loans, that retrenchment cover that Mr. Parks spoke about, which is obviously a problem. That's the first question. The second question is, you've outlined a number of ways in which relief is already possible in terms of the Act, the fantastic progress that you've achieved in emoluments attachment orders, which I think all of us are extremely pleased about, and in terms of reckless lending and the like. So do you think that additional legislative changes are necessary in debt relief in particular, not talking about the changes relating to the powers of the NCR, and if so, what are those? Then, Mr. Parks, again, your presentation, a little bit like the Chamber's, covers a very wide range of topics, some of which are not in the purview or in the scope of this committee's current work schedule, not to say that they're not good ideas. So I will just ask the same question to you. What specific legislative changes would you like to see with regards to debt relief? Because you suggested other amendments that you'd like to see, but those are not related to debt relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Just three questions to the Chamber of Mines. You've noted that there's a practice of bribery of clerks of the court. Can you just elaborate on that and, from your experience, tell us how deep that problem is and whether you would like us to liaise with the Department of Justice on this problem? First of all, secondly, you say that a debt counselling is not really a solution. Do you have any ideas from your side how we can actually improve debt counselling to ensure that it's also a factor that impacts on easy credit? And thirdly, you mentioned that there are certain reasons for debt. Have you noted on your side that reasons for debt are based on pure survival of people, or is there also an element of luxury buying involved? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Korenhoff.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just my question to the Chamber of Mines on the Ecometrics study of 2013. It's interesting, you know, maybe, you know, if you can give me the link, I would like to see that study, you know, in a more proper way. But do you know whether there was any studies conducted when people were acted against because of debt and they lose their motor car and they lose their house in terms of the social impact and then impacting on maybe students or children not pursuing their careers and then lost for, you know, for the labour market? Whether there was any studies conducted.
The Honourable Korenhoff, was there any other member of the committee that wished to make a comment, either Kasatu or the Chamber of Mines, Honourable Eerste-Hazen?
Thank you, Madam. Thank you. I also completely disagree with using pension funds and excess, but the bad news for the economy in South Africa, or the growth, over the years, it is largely hinges on spending, and consumers are continuously driven in the current financial conditions to spend, and feeling this anxiety about their ability to make ends meet, and this unfortunately drives them to more desperate measures and more expensive money. And there's not really anything that you or anybody can do if a consumer goes to borrow money against his retirement fund and also have access. I also agree that debt relief is not an option for me. And we've actually seen what happened to Ellerines and to the African Bank and things. Now, over the weekend, I read in a newspaper that a Foschini group now say that proof of payment is no requirement or a proof of fee is unnecessary. My God, it's mind-boggling. The banks now must secure their loans and their inability or in things. I don't know how something can like that can be stated by a big group like this. And still, unfortunately, the reality, the debt payment, it's still then in the end the poor subsidizing the rich. That's what it basically comes to. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Eerste-Hazen. I can't see who's holding up a hand. Ah, Honourable MacPherson, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry, I was just out of the room when you called for questions. I think just to make the point, you know, the Honourable Nkongi asked, you see that loan sharks should be made criminal. Well, it is a criminal offence, you know, to engage in that sort of lending. But I just want to understand, when you talk about the student loan debt forgiveness, are you referring to Anastas loans or any type of student loans? Because if it is Anastas loans, I mean, that would actually severely compromise the fund from recouping those loans, which then go back into the system for further student loans. So is there a differentiation, or is there sort of a blanket approach to it? But I think that it's also, you know, the issue of debt forgiveness or debt relief is a hugely emotive issue. And I think, as my colleague, the Honourable Hill-Lewis, quite well put in a previous meeting, that, you know, if it's the sort of this, you know, populist reactionary approach, you know, as the department had outlined, that the minister will decide, you know, have these sweeping powers to decide which groups of people it will be in, which province it will be in, you know, it could be anyone. And I think that he termed it really well, and he said, if you think fees must fall, you know, was a national issue, wait until debt must fall becomes a protest. Because if we do it along the lines that the department has outlined, you will have every single community across South Africa saying that their debt must be written off. So I just urge, you know, extreme caution when we look at this issue. I think that, you know, there's a number of good examples that yourself and certainly SATU has identified. But in your opinion, and I'd like to hear from Kasatu as well, you know, how do we narrow the debate to make it an issue of one that is logical and sensible and not one that becomes a populist reactionary discussion?
Thank you very much, Honourable MacPherson. Yes, I have a couple myself. I noticed the Chamber of Mines made reference to now the empowerment and training in the HR section, etc. I would have thought that as soon as the 2007 National Credit Act came out, that would have been done, and so on. So while, yes, it's good that you've now started, it's a little late in the day, isn't it? But the second aspect is that you refer to having a respect for the rule of law and the provisions of the Constitution. Well, I think a lot of the reckless lending has meant that financial houses have ignored the fact that there is a legal requirement to obtain proof of people's remuneration and to apply an affordability test. In fact, I had someone just the other day asking a colleague of mine how much they'd like to increase their current debt by, as it were, borrowing, without any interest in the circumstances that may have changed. So if there's anyone busy breaking the law with impunity, it's a lot of these lenders, and some of the major lenders in this regard. But one, you know, one welcomes some of the initiatives. And yes, I know the subcommittee looked at NINA. This was one of the things that was brought to our attention by the NCR in 2015. The other thing with CASATU is the subcommittee is looking at these target groups, the categories in this regard, because quite clearly they aren't looking at the chair's capacity to get into debt at all. So, you know, we welcome the CASATU input as well, but we must make it clear there are areas you refer us to that are not in the purview of what we are addressing at the moment. But it is now 11:05, or I can just see it. Mine says 11:05. You've each got, you know, about 2 to 3 minutes to address this. Of course, we welcome any written responses. Do go ahead. Who'd like to take the first bite? Mr. Parks?
Okay, thanks very much, Chair. Yeah, I'll just fly through because you put a three-minute cap. I think Honourable Mkongi, I 100% agree with you for agreeing with me. And I'm glad to see Chairperson, that the Honourable Member Mkongi is now reading speeches from iPads. When I first met him, there were no iPads. I think to Honourable MacPherson, yes, no, I think the distinction you raised about NSFAS versus commercial student loans is a very important one. NSFAS has got many progressive provisions within it to try to help protect students. When must they pay back, the interest rates, how they accumulate. We'd want to see the commercial banks, the commercial lending sector, follow those kind of protections of NSFAS. But I think, Chair, even with those good ideas of NSFAS, we can see the student frustration, the missing middle, and so on campuses. It's clearly, it also needs further work. But Honourable McPherson, we also agree we must have a balanced approach, a proactive one. We can't collapse the economy, but as you're saying, we also can't wait until the streets are burning. And hence we kind of propose these various eligible target categories, appeal mechanisms and enforcement. Then Honourable Hill Lewis. I think all the issues we were raising were kind of issues we thought, by and large, could be looked at in terms of legislative amendments, debt cancellation for persons who were victims of reckless lending or criminal lending, not for everybody, but for clearly illegal cases. I think also debt relief for, and you could target those categories, which you mentioned as the indigent categories, but you can also target persons who can motivate retrenchment or the personal emergency, and I think you could also zero in on around the issue of home loans, car loans, small business and small farm loans, you know, major property assets which have an economic impact upon the families and upon society. I think, Chair, you also could look into the law of having provisions for an appeal mechanism within the lender, but even within your consumer bodies, your tribunal, your credit authority, that if I'm not getting joy with a bank, I can appeal to them that my house shouldn't be repossessed. I've had a family emergency, the wife is in the hospital, hence I defaulted, but I'm still committed to servicing the loan. I think also, Chair, there's a need for actions on the issue of auctions. It really is a wild, wild west that many of our members have been paying 15 years. They fell on hard times. They have now lost the house. And of course, if you have an official of the bank who's looking to make a quick buck, there's a need for tightening the laws there. I think, Chair, equally, as Honourable Mkongi says, we would love to see loan sharks being put out of business and going to the mainstream banks as your source of lending. But of course, it means banks must be more accessible to the person, not reckless, but accessible. I think lastly, Chair, maybe the issue of retrenchment insurance should be made compulsory, especially given the state of the economy. I think we need to look at the anti-competitive behaviour amongst bank charges. The Reserve Bank mandate around interest rates, the Reserve Bank said they get the mandate to target inflation. We should push for that to be including the interest rate impact on the economy. Then I think lastly, Chair, the example that I raised before about a major commercial bank also owning a midpoint lending house. So you don't come right by the bank, but you can come to this guy. They're much less stringent, but also they charge much higher interest rates than the commercial banks. Not as high as the loan sharks, but to me it's a conflict of interest. So hopefully that didn't take too long, Chairperson, to answer the Honourable Member's questions.
No, we do appreciate that, Mr. Parks, and we, as I said, we will be engaging further. Ms. Fritz?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, if I can start, thank you for the comments made. Insofar as the two specific questions raised, do employers inform employees of credit life insurance? To the best of my knowledge, this forms a critical part of that financial literacy training, and certain action has been taken in respect of certain providers. What I will do is go and undertake an inquiry of employers whether it is a specific issue that is dealt with at retrenchment. I know it's dealt with in the literacy training, but I cannot comment on that, but I'm happy to go back and investigate it. Any additional debt relief measures, legislation necessary? I think if you'll see from my presentation, the Chamber is largely happy with the existing legislation. We emphasise that there should be a focus on enforcement, particularly Section 80 dealing with reckless lending. Those are really very good provisions, and that's what we would like to focus on. So we don't at this stage have any specific amendments. What we will do is, I will take this back to the task team, the Chamber's task team on employee indebtedness, and obtain a mandate from them and get their views. Insofar as the extent of the bribery of the clerks are concerned, some of the outsourced companies most definitely have been aware, and I do understand that some action has been taken against certain clerks. As to the extent of it, I'm not in a position to comment at this stage, but I will undertake to engage with them and see if we can get a grip on the figures. The debt counselling, we believe that it hasn't worked. As you'll see in my presentation, we've seen that 11,000 clearance certificates have been issued since 2007. So we don't know that it's really working well. We want to focus on the reckless lending and nipping the problem up front with the interest charges and the audits of the EAOs, employees coming to us and revealing their credit history. So although the EAOs might have been changed as a result of some of the financial literacy training, some employees have actually come to these chaps and said, can you help me, can you help me restructure? How can I improve my financial management? So that's very positive. There is an element of pure survival insofar as the indebtedness is concerned. I think people are struggling, and certainly those individuals who are attempting to maintain more than one home, it's really impacting on them. But we've done a study, and unfortunately, the MPF study, the Mine Workers Provident Fund that I referred to, there's a tremendous amount of debt. Luxury cars, cell phones, clothes. We can provide you, if I can get them to permit me to share that study with you, you may find that interesting, because they drill down as to, the percentage of debt. The econometric study, Honourable Member Kornoff, I'm not aware of any study where there's been that social impact study of people, losing their home, their cars. I think that would be very valuable. I'm very happy to forward you the link. I received a study of a summary of the econometrics. It's not going much further. What I can tell you is that the economist at the Chamber of Mines is going to undertake a study in respect of, he's going to look at some of these debt, the indebtedness. So we should come back. Honourable Member Oosthuizen, I agree with you on the retirement scheme. Insofar as debt relief that's been raised, I think from a reading of the report, the Chamber says, yes, it's a trend worldwide, and in principle it's something that one can look at and report. But as I've mentioned, I do not have a mandate, and nor do we have sufficient information before us as to what is proposed in South Africa. So I would need to get a mandate from members, and I agree that we need to study this a lot more closely. And we do not think it should be a populist approach. We would want a logical approach where there is as less impact on the economy as possible. As insofar as the student loans, again, that's an in-principle support. I mentioned that the head of skills development at the Chamber is looking at studies. We'd have to look at how you would apply it in respect of debt relief, in respect of commercial and NSAS. So I was making merely a principled comment. Yes, it looks like it works in the USA. I'm concerned about the timing, the length of time before they get it. But again, we would have to study and work closely with the workgroups before we actively support any debt relief program being instituted in South Africa. Thank you.
Unfortunately, I can't entertain a follow-up unless it is very brief and then will be responded to in writing. So please raise it, Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Chair, I just wanted to make a point mainly to Mr. Parks, but to the Chamber as well, that one of the legislative amendments being considered is empowering the National Credit Regulator with the authority to declare a credit agreement reckless. which gives Section 80 of the Act much more teeth and allows it to be enforced much faster, because you don't have to approach the court each time to have that that agreement declared rectus. And if, of course, lenders disagree with that, then they are welcome to approach the court afterwards. So I think if the NCR has that power, then all of a sudden Section 80 becomes the most important section of the NCA. And if you go and look at the wording of Section 80, it actually is an incredibly powerful section that basically says that any credit agreement that could make the consumer over-indebted at the time the agreement is taken out is reckless. Now that is an incredible power that the NCR will have, hopefully, and I think will give the Act real teeth.
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Unfortunately, I don't have time for your response, Ms. Fritz, but please, this is not going to stop today. And I would hope the Chamber of Mines is taking this so seriously, it's able to pay for your flights. So,
thank you.
Put it in writing, please. Thank you. Right. I understand you got hit by the traffic hold-up on Mr. Nyetse Tensi, DDG. But never mind, Ms. Naidu was here defending you. Right, now we've got Barca. And Barca, I already have a letter from you. Is that not right?
Yes.
Have a letter. And I think, in fact, it's leading me to say, let's allow you less time today and more time listening, and give you a little bit more time the second time round, because we will be having the other banks as well. And I have no doubt you want to hear what your membership is saying. No doubt about that. So you will have time today, rest assured. And looking at the scheduled allocation that we've got here, you can see that you were given 30 minutes by the looks of things. We will give you 15 minutes today. Thank you. Right, go ahead.
Thanks, Chairperson. The letter said that we will give you a detailed written submission by Friday, close of business on Friday. We certainly see this as part, at the beginning of a process, and we would like to engage far more substantively. Let me just also say, I have quite a big delegation here. The banks are here today. But I agree with you that we, at a later date when we have more time, we can discuss things more substantively. And so in the interest of time, if you are happy, Chairperson, immediately after I finish, Tabani from Standard Bank could say a few words, and then we could take the two together for questions. He doesn't have to do a totally different presentation, if that's okay with you. Then just to also say that I haven't been before you personally for a while. And the last time I was before you, we had issues between BASA and DTI and NCR. And I'm glad to say that those issues have been sorted. We have a pretty good relationship now, don't we, folks? So I think that the committee did, you did at that time, Chair, say that we should sort ourselves out, and we have.
Now, I'm pleased to hear that you're all now on friendlier terms. Very good idea.
Two friendly terms.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, but that, nevertheless, is the committee's decision as to how close that friendship is.
Yeah.
But do carry on.
And I would also, again, in the interest of time, suggest that if honourable members have any questions for individual banks, that they perhaps put that in writing and individual banks can respond, or when we have more time. So having said that, let me get into the presentation.
Mr. Saluji, you're not chairing. I am.
Let's get
that straight.
Okay.
I will address the members as to what they will be doing.
Okay.
They're not your members.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Get on with your own.
Okay. Firstly, we support and understand the view of the committee, to get debt relief. And we believe that the approach adopted by the committee to consult with stakeholders will allow for a balanced discussion and produce sustainable outcomes. So we would certainly want to engage with the committee on the detail at some date. We do not support the principle of debt forgiveness. And we do want to differentiate between debt forgiveness and debt relief. One of the banking system's fundamental principles is to be able to efficiently and legally lend money and to collect repayments from borrowers to settle the loan. If that doesn't happen, the banking system falls, and that has significant impacts for the economy and for the credit market. We also believe that the presentation clarified our view on the principle of debt relief. It illustrates the extent of debt relief provided through existing voluntary debt relief measures and talks to current and pending legislative reforms aimed at assisting indebted consumers. So we will be responding to questions that you asked us to respond to directly. So that we get to the heart of the matter. Question one, debt relief mechanisms that are not provided in the NCA. Firstly, the column on the left, the red one, talks about debt relief measures provided for in the NCA. I'm not going to go through them. They're there before you. The one on the right talks to debt relief measures not provided for in the NCA, and amongst those are the debt counseling rule system, and I'll go into that just now, payment holidays and moratoriums, restructuring and rescheduling, debt consolidation, bank-assisted sales, bespoke arrangements, settlement campaigns. And I'm just going to go into each of those very quickly. The debt counseling rule system, DCRS, where debt counselor uses DCRS, the system applies material concessions which go beyond the NCA. Amongst these are decreased interest rates and decreased to as low as zero, the waiving of fees, extension of the term of the credit agreement. And we've actually made substantial progress on this, where we've agreed that the NCR will take responsibility for DCRS. A service provider will manage it, and the industry will contribute towards its operations. Payment holidays, again, it provides the consumer with an opportunity to temporarily suspend payments. Restructuring provides the consumer with an opportunity to restructure extension of term payments, payments of arrears in installments. Debt consolidation to consolidate smaller loans into single loan that's less costly. Bank-assisted sales, providing the consumer with an opportunity to sell either her movable and immovable property. Bespoke arrangements, providing the consumer with an opportunity to enter voluntary payment arrangement. And then settlement campaigns, providing the consumer with an opportunity to settle his or her account at a discount. The underlying principle of the voluntary debt relief measure offered by the bank is that the consumer is able to repay the debt or will be able to repay the debt in the near future when his or her circumstances change, and hence we are not in favor of debt forgiveness. And over a period of time, the debt relief mechanism enables the consumer to get back into the credit cycle. Then just some statistics to show that the voluntary measures are working. This graph looks at the effectiveness of the debt relief provided by debt review as it relates to the number of accounts in default. So if you look at the graph, the total debt review portfolio at the end of September 2016 was 46.155 million rand. The total number of accounts in default decreased from just over 53,000 as of September 2015 to just under 37,000 as of September 2016, a decrease of 30%. This essentially means that over-indebted consumers decreased from approximately 5,000, just under 5,000, to just over 3,000 in September 2016. So that's just to show success of the voluntary mechanisms from the point of view of decreasing over-indebted customers. And the second graph looks at the effectiveness of the debt relief provided by debt review as it relates to the number of clearance certificates accepted. And here, the total number of clearance certificates accepted increased from 770 in September 2015 to 1,574 in 2016, which equates to an increase of 51%. This equates that, which means that the total number of rehabilitated consumers increased from approximately 70 consumers to 143 consumers. And so again, it shows that given from the question of number of clearance certificates issued, we believe the voluntary system is providing results. Then debt relief criteria, we're just giving a couple of examples there of what does happen in the voluntary space. So if you look at example one, where both, well, the two examples, Simon and Thabo both worked in mining, and there was a strike, loss of income, and retrenchment of several workers. So Simon, a single father with two children, was retrenched. The bank suggested to Simon that a claim be submitted against his credit insurance policy as a measure of debt relief. The policy provided for full settlement of the outstanding amount. Thabo, married father with two children, also retrenched, and the bank suggested to Thabo and his wife that their personal loan be restructured, not provided for in the NCA, but voluntarily restructured, thereby extending the term of repayment and reducing the net monthly debt servicing installments. So just two very brief examples of what banks are doing, amongst other things. Related to question three, BASA is of the view that uniform criteria consisting of target group of debtors who will be eligible for debt relief or period in respect of which the debt relief measures will apply and the manner of debt relief measures that must be applied for debt relief, in our view, can't be set, simply because no two consumers' personal circumstances are exactly the same, as was illustrated in those two examples. So while the economic circumstances were the same, both worked for and were retrenched by the same company, their personal circumstances were very different, and so the interaction with the bank and the sort of restructuring and relief that happened is very different. Different credit providers also offer different products and operate within different customer segments, which means that the markets in which they operate are not identical. So we are of the view that flexibility and non-prescriptiveness in respect of the type and application of debt relief measures and debt relief criteria plays a significant role in ensuring a suitable debt relief measure, and we would like to engage on that. Then, as far as impact, consequences, and challenges of legislating debt relief is concerned, we believe that impact, consequences, and challenges of implementing debt relief measures and debt relief criteria through legislative reforms can be broken down into the following areas. The economy. The banking system has, as one of its foundation, an undertaking by borrowers to repay the loans that they obtain from the banks. Any compromise to this principle will have severe consequences for the industry and given the role the industry plays for the economy. Given the current economic environment, Moody's has forecasted that banks will report higher non-performing loans. Coupled together with low growth projections, it has been concluded that SA banks will, over the short to medium period, experience challenges in maintaining strong financial performance. Still perform well, but in maintaining strong financial performance. So we believe that any further pressure introduced by the proposed introduction of legislated debt relief will have negative consequences. Then, a crucial component of an effective banking system is financial stability. And in order to maintain financial stability, we need to demonstrate that we are able to recover money lent to consumers. Any restriction on banks' ability to recover money lent will result in a loss of revenue and erosion of return on capital for investors. They either risk that bank incurring a ratings downgrade as a consequence, and so simply we believe that the principle of money being repaid has got to be maintained. Circumstances can be taken into account, but over a period of time the money needs to be repaid. Then on consumers and credit providers, responsible lending and responsible borrowing go hand in hand and form the core of a sustainable credit market. Debt forgiveness, in our view, will accelerate irresponsible borrowing. Applying standard debt relief or forgiveness measures and debt criteria to targeted populations could be seen to be discriminatory and unconstitutional to consumers who do pay their debt willingly. Then, just again on consumers and credit providers, we don't want consumers who have been paying their debts to be disincentivized to do so in future. There is a moral hazard if we have forgiveness. There exists a presumption in law against the forfeiture of rights, and a statutory provision which gives rise to any such forfeiture must be restrictively interpreted. Standardized debt relief measures and criteria affect the credit provider's rights to enforce its credit agreement and therefore constitutes a forfeiture of rights. We're quoting a case there where the Constitutional Court held that the NCAA requires a balance of the respective rights and responsibilities of credit providers and consumers. Then just on cost of credit and access to credit. Legislated debt relief measures and criteria will make it impossible for credit providers to adequately price for risk for consumers. A consequence, a confluence of pricing, regardless of individual consumer risk, will arise at a portfolio level in order to offset the inability to price for the risk. So this essentially means that consumers who have a good repayment history will no longer be rewarded for such behavior. Access to credit will also decrease due to potential de-risking, and the cost of credit will increase. So in summary, we believe it's not practical to further legislate debt relief measures, as consumers in distress are dealt with on a case-by-case basis, taking their unique circumstances into account. Legislative reforms to introduce additional debt relief measures will have severe consequences for the industry, economy, will increase risk to depositors and savers, will impose a cost on society, and will limit credit providers' ability to extend credit. Then just some, in our view, proposed solutions, Chairperson. One, increasing the uptake and utilization of the DCRS. So I've indicated that we've agreed that the ownership of the DCRS will now rest with the NCR, management by an independent third-party supplier, and an amendment to the condition of registration by the NCR to enforce and increase the utilization of DCRS by credit providers, debt councils, and PDAs. So this will, we believe, increase the volumes of the use of DCRS, and that's one solution. Then the voluntary debt mediation service, banks and other credit providers embarked upon a pilot VDMS with a view of ultimately developing a final debt rehabilitation solution. For various reasons, this didn't go forward, and it is suggested that VDMS be revived. The concept of a voluntary solution based on consensual agreement of debt restructuring proposals benefits consumers in that lengthy and expensive legal and court processes are not required. Then, we suggest that the Portfolio Committee track, monitor, and receive feedback on the implementation of legislative amendments which have recently been enacted or is in the process of being enacted, and we're giving examples. We also suggest the Portfolio Committee review and enable engagements with other government departments in respect of legislative reforms which were suggested but which have stagnated, and we're giving some examples of that as well, Chairperson. Then we suggests that you had mentioned the formation of a committee, a technical committee, and we would certainly welcome interacting in detail with that committee, together with other stakeholders. so that we arrive at a solution to this and a process to this that enables us to narrow differences between us and agree on a sustainable solution. Chairperson, you did mention earlier that what you foresee is a partnership between the public, private sector and other parts of civil society, and we would welcome participating in that in more detail. So let me leave it at that, and I'll ask Tabani to
speak. Right, just a minute.
If that's okay with you.
Thank you. Mr. Kevadia, we do have a subcommittee in Parliament. I would hope they're not a technical committee. Thank you. Now, what we are going to do then, and just so that members know, we will make our comments and raise our questions after the presenter from the Standard Bank, and not before. And the presenter from the Standard Bank is a Mr. Tabani Ndwandwe, Head Personal and Business Banking Credit South Africa. Thank you very much, Mr. Kevadia. Over to you, Mr. Ndwandwe, for the Standard Bank position.
Thank you so much, Chair. Firstly, Chair, we would just like to state that we are part of BASA and we have been working with BASA in all of the work, but we felt that it will help the committee to give some nuance of a bank-specific feel of some of the things that we do. We as a bank truly believe that the issue of indebtedness of the customer, of the consumers, is something to be taken seriously. And we support initiatives to resolve it and to help grow the economy, because we think parts of the problems where you get vulnerable consumers is challenges that we face in the economy, which leads us to the next point that says we feel that there has to be a clear distinction between what we would call purposeful lending and consumption lending, and that always has to be taken into account. In taking the issues of indebtedness as seriously as we've taken them, one of the things we've then, as a result, done is have many engagements with multiple stakeholders, including the NCR, including the DTI, with BASA and outside of BASA, where we've put forward a couple of solutions and suggestions. One of the things we're taking as steps is actually we've stopped writing off debts or sort of repossessing homes where children are heading those households. That's a vulnerable consumer that as a bank, without any legislation, we've chosen to sort of avoid taking homes of child-headed households. That is quite a significant amount of value that we sort of protect. We have taken steps to make sure that people with student loans and where they've had student loans and they can't find employment, we are giving them periods where they get breaks in between until they can find employment. Again, it's an initiative that you do without any sort of legislatives. We've actually put forward, we've got a full-time resource sitting with the NFSAS and NSSAS here in Cape Town, where we've placed to find solutions for student funding and help students to get a way of funding in a way that doesn't indebt them after they finish their studies, and in a way that after they finish the studies, some of the funding can be converted into bursaries and other things. So we are participating quite extensively in this. And internally, to Kess's point, we have set up teams, massive teams that are dedicated into customer assist strategies, because we do believe that when consumers are in difficult times and are going through difficulty, we need to put forward solutions that yield the best results for both the consumer and the bank. So we do that, and we're customer-centric around it. And some of the values we can draw around on a monthly basis, you will hear us telling you that on a monthly basis in a home loan period, we do allow over about 2,000 customers who come to us and request that they want a bit of time, they want a bit of break, they want a bit of respite, and this is something we do on a monthly basis without sort of any legislation. So our position in it is we think there's more to be done in working together to try and find solutions that sustainably solve the problem rather than legislation. We think that if you legislate this, there's enough legislation. We need to make sure that legislation is enforced. We need to make sure that the processes we've got are leveraged and they're leveraged properly, and we're working on those processes together with the regulators and ourselves to make sure that we are sort of making headway there. Some of the things that we just think is important to start thinking about is maybe putting programs in place where we focus our energies to say those people who are retrenched, how do we support those people who are retrenched in making sure we do enterprise development, help them convert them into self-sufficient consumers rather than removing debt, because I think that doesn't necessarily make them self-sufficient consumers downstream. One of the things we've put together is a fund that our CEO, Sim Shabalala, has put together of $400 million, where we've set it as an enterprise development program to try and test this thing. So I think these are the things that we can sort of work together and leverage and pull different pockets and across. Just like the pastor as well, we would be happy to avail ourselves fully with all our resources to help participate in shaping the outcome, giving input and giving guidance. And I think with all that we've got, if we really just pull some of everything that we've got and work together, we think we can find a sustainable solution. And as a bank, we actually believe that we can solve this together with you, but we will need your help as well, as we've documented some of the stuff to our regulators and the DTI. Thank you so much for giving us time.
I've just been informed by Mr. Hermans, the committee secretary, that Standard Bank will be submitting their document on Friday. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Just so that all members are aware of that. Now, members, you can engage both. Certainly, you've heard the verbal input of Standard Bank, and you have got the written presentation of BASA, although this is not the complete one, I hasten to add. I see the Honourable Mkongi, the Honourable Williams, the Honourable Alberts, the Honourable Esterhazen, the Honourable, is it Hill Lewis? The Honourable Hill Lewis, MacPherson, Honourable Van Schalkwyk, Honourable Krenhoff. And it's now just on 11:45. Let's give you 3 minutes. Don't have the preamble because it cuts down your time. Thank you. Straight away, Honourable Mkongi.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I also wanted to welcome both the presentations. There are issues that we must hit on as we debate this particular matter. And one of the things is the selection or selectivity in terms of the banking fundamentals. One of the banking fundamentals is risk control and monitoring of the clients, which goes to the heart of who are you giving loans to and for what. Because the question of loaning for consumption is a strategic problem in our own country, because most of the banks do not loan for development and assisting the country to make sure that we deal with triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and inequality. So we must not be selective when we look at the fundamentals that govern, a sound banking system in a country. Two, the question of voluntary debt mediation services is unsustainable. Because if APSA doesn't want to volunteer, what are we going to say? If First National Bank does not volunteer, what do we say? So the issue should be a compulsory debt relief program for qualifying households based on the categories. The debate must stick on categories and sustainability, because I think it's untrue that the question of the compulsory debt relief system is going to impact on productivity, investment, and economic growth. It can also reinforce that, you see,
Because we must understand, what are we lending for? Because if we're going to lend people for buying groceries only, that is a fundamental problem of the banking system in South Africa. So I'm saying, Chairperson, these are the issues that we look. So if we talk about the sound banking system in South Africa, let's deal with all the fundamentals and look at the fundamentals, whether they assist in the developmental trajectory of the country, because we've got national goals and banks should be part and parcel of completing those national goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi. Honourable William.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to talk about, it was alluded or it was said that if we go ahead with debt forgiveness, that the cost of credit will increase. And I'd like to know why the cost of credit didn't increase when the banks saw our South African economy collapsing around us, massive retrenchments. Why didn't you increase the credit, the cost of credit then? Now you're using it as almost like a threat to us. But before, when you saw our economy collapsing or a recession kicking in, you could have initiated more expensive cost of credit so that there would be less indebted people. I'd like to know, why didn't you do it back then? Also, secondly, in order to address a problem, any problem, we need to go to the source of that problem. And the source of our indebted society in South Africa is the banks. So I'd like to know from both Barsa and the Standard Bank, what responsibility do you think the banks should take for our over-indebted society? And lastly, Chairperson, I just want to know what Barsa and Standard Bank think of the NINA system, income, no assets. If that targeted group, what do you think about that? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation by Barsa. Just two questions. It seems from our point of view that the banks do give credit quite easily because of the surge of credit that is taking place. And despite all of the interventions, legislative interventions and so forth put in place to curb that, banks have embarked on aggressive methods of trying to sell easy credit to people, phoning them blindly, asking them whether they want credit cards. And actually that's happened quite soon after 2008. It started again, as if no lessons were learned. So that's worrisome to me. And then secondly, what steps have the banks taken, when they do pounce legally on a person who has not paid their debt and then sell in execution their homes and cars or whatever might be indebted to protect the integrity of the sale and execution, to ensure that those assets are sold for market-related prices and not just sold willy-nilly at any price for a friend inside to a friend inside the bank, which happens, and then these people are still stuck with the debt forever in a day. So I think the lesson to be learned is that the banks have to take an introspection and they have to take more responsibility when it comes to handing out money to people in the streets and then expecting them to pay it back and putting them into dire straits. Thank you very much.
Honourable Albert, Honourable
Esterhazen. Chair, I have to agree with the opening statement of the first presenter. I would think it's also completely wrong for financial institutions just to write off bad debt. I think there would be more, the obligation should be more on the consumers and on counselling for them to avoid bad debt. As the prudential regulators, the bank needs to make decisions and have the oversight over the prudence and the soundness of all South African financial institutions. Our financial institutions are already very heavily regulated and burdened by regulations and legislations and things, and that actually helped, and for all the global financial headwinds and things, that actually helped the financial institutions in South Africa. But something also that I've seen quite recently is that now in the EU, they're starting to implement or they're starting to force banks to begin building in defenses to even before Lynn and Sauer, they will save safety, and this will very much affect the bank's capital in EU. Is there anything in the maybe in the here about this in South Africa? That will be a very bad thing for the banks.
Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Kubadia, and your colleague from Standard Bank. Two quick scenarios that I'd like your comments on. When a bank loans money to a customer to purchase a house, a normal home mortgage, they charge an interest rate which includes some kind of risk premium. The bank takes on some risk that the customer will default. But currently in South Africa, our reading of the situation is that there really isn't very much risk in home loans, because even if the customer does default, you will repossess the home, sell it in execution, and the customer will still be liable for any shortfall. And you can then pursue them through normal debt recovery mechanisms. So is that a scenario that in which you would be willing to consider to assume some more of the risk that is supposed to be inherent in the mortgage relationship between bank and customer, which I don't see existing at present? The second scenario is that I agree that the debt counselling process has got incredible potential to assist indebted consumers to rearrange their debts, to have their interest rates reduced to zero, their fees reduced to zero. It is really very significant debt relief that is already built into the Act. The trouble is that it never works for poor consumers, because debt counsellors can't make any money. The debts are inadequate, the fees are inadequate for a debt counsellor to ever take on a low-income consumer. As a result, the only consumers that ever use debt counselling are middle-income consumers. So what can you as banks do to make debt counselling more accessible for poor consumers? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. Honourable Maxer.
Thank you very much. I mean, the picture that you paint is somewhat of a, you know, economic Armageddon. If we were to go down this route, are you being, you know, a bit hysterical in that, or is it really that bad? Because I think that there's a big misunderstanding between your smaller credit providers and the big banks, in that they are able or willing to take on more risk than the big banks are. I mean, I know that banks aren't my favourite institutions. I think they make it quite difficult to acquire assets, and I understand why, and I think that those regulations have saved a lot of people from getting in over their heads. And so I would be interested to see what the rate of reckless lending is amongst the smaller credit providers as opposed to the established traditional banks, and I think that would speak to where the problem lies by and large, and I'm just guessing, and you can help me, Mr. Kubadia, in that guess, that the unsecured reckless lending exists in the smaller credit providers than it does in the bigger providers. Is that true?
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm mostly covered by the previous colleagues. I also, my question is directed to Standard Bank with regards to the initiative of stop repossessing of child-headed household homes. My question is actually, at which stage are you considering this initiative? Because you might find that the home loan has just been approved only for a few months, and then the parents die or something like that. So are you, at what stage do you welcome the or implementing this initiative? And also I want to know what's happening to the debt if you're not repossessing the home. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Now, as I said to the previous stakeholders, and especially in Vasa's case, who will be returning to us, we know, please try to give us succinct responses and then address it in your detailed presentation, the balance, and the same with Standard Bank. Over to you, Mr. Kuvadia.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'll try to be quick and the rest we can respond to in our detail. Honorable Nkongi, the view that we are selective in terms of banking fundamentals, we are referring to fundamentals that pertain specifically to this discussion at this committee at this point in time. I think that in a broader discussion on banking and what some of the critical issues are in banking at the moment, we would refer to other fundamentals as well. So it's not being selective. It's just looking at the banking environment within the context of, one, the overall regulatory environment for banks, two, the global pressures on banks and the global regulations on banks and what that means. And we have to factor all of those in when we looking at different parts of our business. So if we've come across a selective here, we've identified one fundamental that directly relate to the question of credit and what the focus of the committee is at the moment. But in a broader discussion on banking, which we hope in the detail we have the opportunity to engage on, we'd like to look at other fundamentals as well. With regard to voluntary debt mediation being unsustainable, that's one of the reasons why we've got the DCRS rules on, and now with the NCR taking over DCRS, making it the condition of registration that credit providers use DCRS, that then increases the volume that all credit providers would use DCRS. So, you know, if you want the debt restructured, I don't know, 11, 12 credit providers that a borrower has, instead of taking a borrower to court and so on, it through the voluntary process, use of DCRS, you can restructure that debt, and you don't have to take that to court. It's in your interest to do so, and I think more debt providers will do so. Then the issue about consumer lending and to a certain extent Honorable Williams touched on this as well, that banks actually cause over indebtedness. People are borrowing money, Honorable Members, because we're not creating jobs, because our economy is not growing, because people need to borrow money to put food on the table. Okay, if banks do not provide that credit, people will go to machinists. That's a reality. The demand for credit is not going to go down if the banks don't provide credit. And while, let me not be romantic about this. Have there been bad credit decisions amongst banks? Absolutely over a period of time. But if I have to look balance bank credit to Mashonisa credit, it's a non-discussion. So it's not that banks are creating the indebtedness. It's that economic conditions, lack of jobs, the inequalities in our society create situations where people need money, people need to borrow money. And I'd rather people go to the banks to borrow that money than to a Mashonisa. So I think that we just need to make that point. Then the issue about cost of credit and why when the economy was collapsing around us, cost of credit didn't go up and so on. Well, cost of credit did go up and credit actually dried up to a certain extent. Simply because the risk of issuing their credit became too great. The issue of no income, no assets, we're still looking at this, we're still researching it and investigate it in our detail. We will come back to you, Chair. The issue of banks giving credit too easily, you know, if maybe Tabani can respond to that as well in what an individual bank does, but we've been quite cooperative with the NCR and DTI to put into place mechanisms to ensure that we go through proper processes to look at clients before we give credit. Banks are heavily regulated institutions. It's not only the NCR that oversees us. The Reserve Bank oversees us as well. And the Reserve Bank is not too happy if we actually act in an irresponsible manner. So I would respectfully disagree that banks give credit too easily. I think there are mechanisms and regulations in place to ensure that we go through proper process of affordability checks, etc. And if we're not doing that, then I think we must actually bear the brunt of those regulations. Sales in execution, we are doing some work on this at the moment, Chairperson, which we would present to this committee. Just to go through in detail how this works, what we're doing, if there's fraud or other deficiencies in the system to try and identify those. But we're doing a piece of work, we're sort of close to finishing it, and so that we can actually present to this committee and go through in detail how this works, and we will respond to that. Honorable, yes, Kaylin, I just need to, Chairperson, if you will allow, I wasn't too clear on your question. If I could just ask Honorable Yesterday to repeat that. I accept and I appreciate you saying that you agree with our opening comments and so on, but you raised a question, and if I could just get clarity.
Honorable Yesterday.
There was a question about the EU implementing new...
Yeah.
What I was saying, what I've written down here, that new rules are starting, I've read it somewhere over the weekend as well, that new rules are starting to be implemented, or they're thinking of doing it. I'm not 100% sure, I can't remember exactly the details. Forcing banks to begin building in defenses because of what happened in Greece and Turkey and what we've all seen. That even before a loan turned sour or something bad happened, they must build in reserves now, which will definitely affect their bank capital. And how will this affect, will it become that in South Africa as well?
Okay, thank you. And these are part of the Basel III regulations. Basel III was introduced primarily because of what happened in Europe. I think we need to note that we didn't have a financial crisis in our country. We had an economic crisis. But none of our banks got into trouble. African Bank was a different story. It wasn't as a result of the European crisis. But what Basel III does is to actually, given what happened in Europe, is to actually say for certain types of bank business, different types of reserve requirements are necessary. So if the riskier your business, the more reserves you will need with it to actually guard against that business going bad. So that does apply to us, essentially. Then, Honorable Hill Lewis, on the mortgage issue, Pragnesh from NetBank have indicated that he would respond, if that's okay, Chairperson. On the debt counselor's issue, I mean, that's why we're saying that the voluntary debt mediation system needs to be revived. And in the voluntary debt mediation system, what we said is that we, instead of debt counseling, let's have debt mediation, which we can actually assist in the cost of, and we can actually facilitate with the customer. And voluntarily restructure that. We recognize that you know, extremely poor people cannot afford the debt council. I'm not going to speak on behalf of debt councils about the way they operate. But we do understand that's the problem, and that's why we're suggesting that VDMS be actually revived. Honorable McPherson, is it economic Armageddon? I think that as a banking sector, we do need to look at even extension of credit within the context of the global regulatory factors on banks, within the context of a very slow, in fact, an economy that's barely growing and therefore the volumes of bank business are down. If that continues over a protracted period of time, what are currently very stable and strong banks begin to be impacted on. If we get a ratings downgrade, that has a significant impact on us. So we're not just saying that it's the credit environment that would cause this, but we need to look at the broader architecture around banks.
Mr. Kavadia, I really can't give you an hour. You are coming again.
Okay.
I have your letter requesting this, and we have agreed. Synced responses.
Okay, Chair, I will only respond to the questions that Mr. Kavadia hasn't responded to save time. I guess the one question that Mr. Kavadia has asked me to speak to is the whole concept of irresponsible lending. And Mr. Williams, I guess, Honorable Williams, it's not in our interest to generally do irresponsible lending. It's just not in our interest to do irresponsible lending. We do our best to make sure that our processes are clear, we've got strong policies, we don't accept just everyone. In fact, most of the complaints we get nowadays is that we're not absorbing enough. So we really have a lot of stringent processes within ourselves, plus the affordability rules that the NCA puts upon us makes it even more stringent. But wherever we found ourselves having faltered, we take full responsibility for those, and we'll definitely at any given point in time where we faltered write those debts off, because we have no interest in doing bad business. The question that is probably directed to me as well, to Standard Bank, is Honorable Frans Kalkwijk, around when do we sort of do selective realization of security. It really is on a case-by-case basis, particularly understanding the individual circumstances of each family and the estate that's left behind. Because unfortunately, there's some cases where the estate is held by another family member and they're not releasing it to their family, and then in that case, we can't intervene in those things. But when there's really dire circumstances for the children and they're sitting in their homes, we will not touch those properties. And even when there's other issues that are maternal in nature in terms of families, we hold back on our processes until we understand everything, because we don't like leaving kids destitute.
Right, thank you very much. Now, members, I'm glad Honourable Van Skalkwijk was responded to. I'm not sure about yourself, Honourable Korenhoff, but I thought you were. Right. Now, there are just a couple of comments I want to make, Mr. Kavadia. In the presentation you've given us, notwithstanding you will be returning, etc., is at one point you talk about responsible lending and responsible borrowing. I don't think we could agree more with that. The regrettable factor is that we often think of irresponsible borrowers, and yet the reality is there are more than enough irresponsible lenders. I've got letters on my desk telling me about a major bank that is offering loans to clear up loans when the people are out of work. They are unemployed. How does that bank expect a repayment to be made? How? This is from a major bank. We're not talking about fly-by-nights or whatever. So let's not just look at all the irresponsible borrowers. No. We do need, and I think the Chamber of Mines could well teach bankers a couple of lessons. Study MENA. No income, no asset. And you'll understand why it may be necessary to consider this. Because I don't think anyone here from any opposition party or the ruling party has a difference there. They all want to try and see what can be done in a responsible manner. And the fact is, too many huge organizations on the furniture side and the financial side have ignored the 2007 National Credit Act. That's a reality. So I'm not sure why banks refuse to acknowledge this. I do know that individually they do acknowledge this. And that is why I would like it to be quite clear to the bankers sitting here. I shall personally sign the next letter, because you may have taken it a little lightly, because the secretary of the committee signed the last letter. I shall be signing the next letters, and I would like to see each bank here answerable for themselves. When we invite the steel industry, we have the steel associations that come, and we have the respective players and stakeholders in steel. I see no reason to make an exception with the financial sector at all. So they're here, but we want their inputs. Now, we are going to ask Barsa to come back at the end of that process. I'm aware they're here. Mr. Maxson?
Sorry, Chair, I actually think that you're actually being quite unfair. You know, the industry is here, and all of the banks are here. Ask them to make input, and they'll make input, but you can't come here and flag them all off and say they're not here to make input, when in fact they actually are.
What I am saying, Honourable Macpherson, is that in the past, and they are all aware of this, they have made their inputs. When we're making inputs at the moment, we want to see the presentation. So I said I will personally invite such presentations myself as chair. I did not do that on this occasion. Do you understand? I thought I made that very clear. Now, I'm not turning this into a dialogue. The other point that we agree with here is the one in which you indicate the need for all of us to come together. That is exactly what the subcommittee is trying to do. And I happen to know that the subcommittee wants to invite some of the stakeholders to share with them further information. So Mr. Williams, the Honourable Williams, will deal with that quite separately to this broader committee. I hope that's clear. And no, we're not taking decisions now. We need to hear what you have to say first. And if you believe that this committee has ever operated in any other manner, do let me know in writing. I should have mentioned, but I was reminded that the advocate Van der Merwe is here. She's attached to the committee during this process. Because initially we were exploring a committee bill. And we now are having a broader exploration on the matter. Just so that that's very, very clear. And it is such engagements that may persuade us to go this voluntary route or another route. As yet, I understand even the subcommittee continue to explore. Am I correct, Mr. Williams, Honourable Williams?
Yes, Chairperson, you're correct. We haven't come up with a definitive answer to this yet. Thank you.
So that's where we are. Now, we have persuaded the Black Sash, who hadn't had the full presentation here earlier, and of course it is here now, but we have persuaded them to come the following Friday to enable us to finish in the time we have available. I'm saying this actually for the committee members. Secondly, committee members, before you leave, because some of you do may leave beforehand, the Tuesday meeting, which was scheduled, has been overtaken by the change in the parliamentary programme, in which the Speaker has scheduled a joint sitting on Tuesday morning. So we will be unable to meet on Tuesday morning. I hope everyone's listening. So we have requested, and this applies to the banks, we have requested Thursday afternoon, because I did tell you that it would either be Thursday afternoons and evenings or Friday. Some of you will recall that. So that is what has been requested. Am I right? Fine. So if everyone's on board with that. Yes? Honourable Hill-Lewis?
Which Thursday, Chairperson? We need to diarise that.
That will be this Thursday. Because we may need to offer the next Thursday as well, you see. So we thought it wise to at least address that now.
Next Thursday are the votes and schedules on the medium-term budget, so we can't meet next Thursday because we have to be in the House.
So I'm sure you're all aware of the challenges we're facing on the programme. Am I correct? So let's try and stick with this. Mr. Herman? Right. Now, on that note, can we please, and thank you very much.
Sorry, Chairperson, if I may. Sorry. You said that this also applies to the banks. Are we expected to be here on Thursday?
Invite you, because the point is this. I believe, from what you said in the letter, your intention was to come Friday.
Chair, in our letter we said that we will make available a written submission to the committee by close of business on Friday.
Right, but the point is we would have preferred to have it, notwithstanding that we are going to invite you along with the banks. You are, after all, the association, and heading that as Managing Director, Mr. Kuzadia. So with the committee secretary you can correspond. I wanted to point out the changes there, so we'll carry on. 12:15, we've got the input from the large non-bank lenders association. I wasn't even aware of your association, I'm sorry. Honourable Hill-Lewis?
Chair, I'm very sorry to go back. The presenter from the chamber mentioned a report which I would like to ask if the secretary or content advisor could track down for us the World Bank report on the Indian debt relief program, which I think will be very helpful for us to read. Thank you.
Thank you. That I overlooked, so thank you for raising it. Can we now move on to the LNBLA? Chairman of the LNBLA, and then you've got a Director, Legal and Compliance, Old Mutual, Mr. Guy Harker. Sorry, can you correct me then, because that's what I've noted, got noted here.
Thank you. Chair, it's my first time here, so please bear with me. My name is Rudolf Willemster. I'm the chairperson of the Large Non-Bank Lender Association. There was possibility that Mr. Guy Harker from RTS would have joined me in the presentation, but that's not happening.
Right, so now that we have the explanation, do go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. As you said, it's the first time that we are presenting in this house. So if I can just tell you a bit about the Large Non-Bank Lender Association. We comprise some of the larger lenders. We're not banks, and our members don't include the members of the MFSA. And typically these products include unsecured loans, credit facilities, and also developmental credit. The members of the organization are Sun and Personal Loans, Old Mutual Finance, RCS Investment Holdings, Real People, Home Finance, Bayport Financial Services, Home Choice, and the JD Group. I must just mention that because of the short time or short notice we've received, I haven't had endorsement of this presentation by Sun and Personal Loans, so don't attribute what I'm saying here to them. I can, however, say that the presentation was also made available to the NCRF, that's the National Clothing Retail Federation of South Africa, who has not been invited to be here, and to also express support for the comments in this presentation, as well as the MFSA, who has not been invited to be here. So the invitation that we've received is to present on viable debt relief measures. Now, as I looked through the presentation, I came to realize that probably when I refer to debt relief, I should probably qualify, so when I speak about that, I actually speak about legislated debt relief. But to say we, first of all, very happy to be here to engage on this issue. We believe it's a very important issue. From the invitation, it's clear that the committee wants to engage around what, and I can say legislated debt relief should look like, although I think the industry is more at the point where it asks whether legislated debt relief is really the desirable and only solution that should be considered. We believe that the issue is complex and that it requires detailed research and consideration. I think we must at the same time say that, and make it clear that, of course, as an organization, we have compassion with over-indebted people and also with the poor. Our point of difference is what is the appropriate solution to deal with the challenge. I will quickly highlight the four themes that I want to deal with in my presentation as to why we do not embrace legislated debt relief. Firstly, we believe that there is an existing statutory solution in the form of debt counselling. We've heard earlier today that it's not perfect, but certainly there are problems which have been identified and there's a way forward on it. And I will deal with that in more detail just now. Then it must be said that over the past 2 years we've seen as credit providers many mechanisms being introduced by government. Most of them were intended directly or indirectly to address over-indebtedness. And, you know, there's a range of them, and I'll deal with them in some detail. But we've seen amnesty, we've seen prescription intervention in Duplum, CAPS, EO reform, a number of initiatives. And the question must be asked, how many of those have been effective? How many of those have we already seen the true impact, and how many of them one should wait to see what the impact will be? We must also state that the NCR research, which we've had a look at, we do not believe that that is a basis to move forward on legislative debt relief. If I read it, it rather points me in the opposite direction. And that's no criticism of the research, just what does that research really tell us? And I think we're looking at it from different perspectives. Finally, we are concerned about the unintended consequences of legislative debt relief, and I'll have something to say about that. Debt counselling has been specifically enacted to provide a solution to over-indebtedness. In fact, at the time when it was enacted, the idea was that something like administration orders should in fact disappear, because this would be the only mechanism. We all know that the legislation left many gaps and problems. There are certain areas which weren't properly addressed in the legislation, and a lot of that had to be resolved through industry task teams. Currently, the processes are further refined through the industry. Debt counsellors and the NCR are working through the Credit Industry Forum to make debt counselling more effective. As you heard from Mr. Kavaria, the DCRS is an important element hereof, and the large non-bank lenders is supporting the initiatives in this regard. We must ask whether how effective have the measures been that have been introduced by government. We can have a lot to say about some of them in particular, but I think let me just say that it is very clear that the amnesty didn't help anybody in this country to, if anything, it helped some people to get into more debt, and it helped other people not to take out loans but when they actually needed to and would otherwise have qualified. So some of these measures have an impact, some of them
have not. Just excuse me a moment, what amnesty are you talking about?
The amnesty on information, adverse information that had to be removed.
Sorry?
It's the amnesty on information that had to be removed from the bureaus.
Can't hear, just you talking to the mic.
Is the amnesty related to the information that had to be removed from the bureaus, adverse information? So we say some of these measures have had impact, some is still to have an impact, but the concern for us is that all along there hasn't been proper regulatory impact assessments, and I want to plead with this House to not move forward on any measure, legislative debt relief measure, unless there's a proper impact assessment on credit providers. I've said that the research conducted by the NCR does not provide a basis to move forward. I don't believe that it's conclusive and that it's a justification for the introduction of additional measures. Just to say a few things about it, if you look at the measures quoted there, they do not amount, normally it talks about plans, it's not mere write-offs. Normally the state, in essence the taxpayer, pays for it. Those measures that are spoken about do not seek to assist those who borrowed irresponsibly, specifically. There's no indication in the research that we've seen that actually pointed towards any of these measures being successful. And then they also relate to situations where there's no statutory solution like debt counselling in the NCA. Many of those countries where there was a debt relief program, it was because there was no effective other mechanism. I want to talk about the impact on credit providers. Debt relief, we believe, must not have the effect of causing additional losses for credit providers. We've been through what may be called in certain quarters a regulatory tsunami. Credit providers absorb the regulation of considerable impact. And any further impact will affect credit provider sustainability, implications for economic growth, and it could have systemic risk consequences. I think it's very important that when we regulate credit providers, we must understand you're not only in effect regulating the credit provider, you're also regulating in effect those who provide funding to credit providers. So there's a whole chain of interests which are impacted. Credit providers develop mechanisms outside of the NCA to assist their customers to repay their loans. I mean, any credit provider would be stupid not to listen to a request from a borrower to allow him to make a promise to pay, to reschedule his loan, to consolidate his loans, and in some cases there are also discounts offered, settlement discounts. Most of those are based on the borrower's personal circumstances. And as Mr. Kavaria pointed out earlier, it is very necessary to look in each case and each borrower individually, rather than to paint with a broad brush. I think it's also important to note that significant amounts of bad debt are written off by the credit industry annually as a result of non-payment. It's not like there's no amounts being not repaid. So, in effect, there is, let's call it, the informal debt relief happening in a certain way already. There's some other considerations that we believe should also take into account. It has been suggested that reckless lending could justify debt relief. While some credit providers have always been compliant, others have not. And the question must be asked whether debt relief programs across the industry can ever be an appropriate response to ring-fence alleged non-compliance with certain credit providers. The general statement is made that there's been a lot of reckless lending, hence there should be debt relief, but surely it should only be targeted at those that didn't comply, which is not so easy to determine. Finally, we are at a time when pressure in South Africa to show growth and financial discipline cannot be ignored. And the question is, how do you reconcile a debt relief program with those imperatives? So, in conclusion, we don't see legislated, and I again want to add the word legislated debt relief as a desirable option. We believe that we should make debt counselling work, and we're prepared to put money and hard work into that. It will be very difficult for credit providers to absorb further impact, regulatory impact. And then it's, of course, of utter importance for the future of South Africa that consumers should be encouraged to meet their obligations rather than avoiding it. In the research conducted by the NCR, there is a quote which I think is one which is important, which says, right, reduces the issue of moral hazards. It is difficult to write off loans without writing off a culture of prudent borrowing and repayment. I'm not suggesting that all lending has been prudent, neither that all borrowing has been prudent, but once you tamper with the whole notion of the enforceability of obligations and the need to meet obligations that you've committed to, then I believe we are on a slippery hill. I think that concludes my presentation, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Willems. So I'm going to take both yourself and the Debt Counsellors Association, and then we'll have questions and comments. So if we can have the Debt Counsellors up, and that's Mr. Slott, President of DICASA.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As stated, I'm from the Debt Counselling Association. We're responsible for about 75% of the debt applications in the country at this point in time. I think it's said over and over is that we need a solution for the high household debt in South Africa. We recently conducted a research on 30,000 consumers who did not apply for debt review, and in that case we found that about 92% of those consumers had monthly income between 3 and 20,000. So the consumers below 20,000 seems to be at the high end of the receiving end in terms of when they apply for debt review. The problem, however, that we face with is a lot of the consumers have not applied for debt review, and how do we actually address that situation, because they're still out there. There's 9 million consumers that are missing payments. Not all of them are debt review applicants, but they are not enticed to apply for debt review. We did a survey on 5,500 consumers recently who have not applied for debt review, and those consumers had an average income of 15,500 rand, but the aggregate debt repayments was 64% of the after-tax income. And that makes it very difficult for those consumers to actually live. So I think those consumers have not considered debt review. We have to ask ourselves why. And it's clear that those consumers need help and they need to actually restructure their situation very, very soon. So the normal reaction that we see from consumers who are in financial trouble is the following. Is that the normal consumer, 54% of them would actually, as first reaction, apply for more debt. 43% nothing, and they wait for somebody to take legal action. And only 5% will actually seek help. So they will go out and say, I have a problem, they recognize they have a problem, and they'll start to do something about it. And then of those consumers who seek help, is that based on our experience, is that most of them take up to a year to do something about it. So it's not something that they do very quickly, because it's also true to say the sooner they engage to seek help, the easier it is to help them. The longer they wait, obviously the opposite is true. So the central challenge around financial crisis support is that consumers are not compelled to seek help. And how do we entice those consumers to seek help? So in our view, the requirement for a successful debt relief program is one, convince consumers in trouble not to consider more debt, and that's a difficult task. We have to provide solutions for consumers to show them the light at the end of the tunnel, because it obviously takes a while for this to work. And then how can we reward good behavior of some of those consumers who are actually repaying the debt? So those are the three elements that we think is important. But before we start with that, I think we have to say that let's look at the NCA. NCA has a profound and positive impact on South Africa. And everywhere we go from overseas delegations, they say, if only we had the NCA, we would have been much better. So it's a fantastic piece of legislation. But I think the NCA could be improved in three areas which I want to mention. The first one is that we have a fantastic section 126B on prescription, but we're not so sure that it is implied or it's actually easy to actually implement all that way. We believe it should be compulsory for credit providers confirmed on all credits, on all certificate of balance and statements or when they're selling to books that the debt has not prescribed. It's very difficult to get that information. In Dublin, section 1035 has been a problem for the last 10 years where there's different legal implementations of the section 1035, and there's still uncertainty which is impacting on the implementation. I think the consumer is paying for that. And then last one, which is a recent one, is the minimum expense norms in regulation 9 and 10 is protecting the poor, but is very liberal in terms of the other income levels, where the threshold is simply not high enough in terms of the affordability guidelines. So, but if we then go to, say, move forward to say, but DGRS has been implemented. Now, when we started with debt review in 2009, we were in the wilderness and we had to actually do something to make things something happen, and that's where DCS was born. And I'm very, very glad to hear the fantastic support for DCS, because that's the one thing that we have to make work in this country, as it provides substantial interest and benefits for the consumers. And credit providers have agreed substantial concessions for in terms of fees and interest rates. And these concessions are in the TASTIM agreement. And if applied 100%, the consumer's cash flow can improve by about 39%. So it's a substantial benefit that we have in the DCRS system. And unfortunately, DCRS usage is low at the moment. I think through certain identified system issues and non-acceptance by some industry players. And we welcome the step to actually make it compulsory for all to actually make this happen. And it cannot happen sooner because a lot of consumers can actually benefit from DCRS. And it should be our first line of defense in making this happen. But if you actually look at this, I think it's the quote is getting into debt, in particular getting out of debt, are really singular and brief events in a person's life. So getting into debt is probably happens much, much quicker than getting out of debt, and it's a question is how do we actually manage that process going forward? And we want to propose a little bit more in terms of debt relief and based on these principles. I think there has to be fairness to the consumers and credit providers. It has to include, and based on the current financial position of the consumer and the future financial position of the consumer, the immediate debt relief for consumers without any means to pay. There must be a method for them, and linking the ability to pay and good behavior with the relief that has been offered. So obviously that will place a little bit of an emphasis on secured assets, and we say that should be researched a little bit more to say how does it fit into the proposed model. We're proposing an out-of-court debt relief agreement, which starts with the assessment of the consumer, where the affordability is assessed as we're doing it in debt review at this point in time. And if the consumer qualifies for statutory debt review in DCRS, that has to be the first option in all cases. And as you know, DCRS, the aim is to get the consumer out of debt review within 60 months. Our experience is where the debt review has been approved by the credit providers, they actually get out of debt review within an average of about 32 months. So it proves that DCRS is working. And the reason why it's 32 months is that the consumers actually start to pay a little bit higher amounts as they get out of the difficult position. So that DCRS must be the first option. But we also want to propose that we have a sort of a DCRS plus to calculate repayments for those consumers who do not qualify for DCRS. And there we also want to say we want to include NCR and non-NCR debt. There's a substantial amount of debt outside the NCR that has not been addressed at this point in time. We're talking about municipal debt, cell phone debt, and it makes it difficult to restructure the account of a consumer when there's no solution for those debts. So we're also proposing that the minimum affordability threshold for a consumer is to be set at a percentage of the salary to create fairness in the process. And the maximum solve term has to be longer than 5 years. We're not prescriptive in terms of what it is, but it has to be a little bit longer than 5 years. And it has to include free fee and interest rate concessions that we see at the moment as well. The payments can be collected and distributed by the PDAs as we have at the moment, but then some light at the end of the tunnel to offer a client a good behavior discount for paying on time on an ongoing basis. We see this time and again when the consumer can see the benefit of actually paying on an ongoing basis, that they stick to the repayment program. Credit providers love it as well because they're continuous payments. And if there's some sort of benefit for the consumer, defined benefit up front, I think they might be able to stick to the program more than what we have at this point in time. So the future improvement, the ability to pay, could also mean that they can reach the point of good behavior a little bit sooner. Instead of the 7 years or 8 years or whatever you propose, that period can be reduced if they actually pay a little bit faster in terms of the process. So on receipt of the good behavior discount, then we propose that the debt is repaid in full and the credit bureaus updated accordingly. If the consumer, so in essence what we're proposing here is a DCRS plus with some rules in it, a little bit longer period, but a carrot at the end for the consumer to say if you do X, we will actually provide you with a reward at the end of the process. If the consumer does not qualify for the secondary program, then they probably don't have the means to pay, and I think the only thing that will work there is a poor man's sequestration that will bring immediate release for the individual. There's nothing else that you can do to help that individual. So in order for us to make this work, we need debt relief rules and guidelines to make sure that everybody plays and agrees by the rules. It has to be compulsory and binding to all players. There should be suspension of enforcement by credit providers that will be required. And the good behavior discount needs to be agreed up front. I'm not specifying what that should be, but some sort of a benefit at the end of the process. The process could be defined in legislation. And very important consideration here is that access to new debt should be suspended during the debt relief process. What we very often see is consumers go into a debt relief program, but the very next day they can't resist this offer of credit and they actually get into debt much, much more sooner than what they should do. Existing process to be adopted to cater for out-of-court debt relief.
Chairperson, can I just ask a clarity question?
You know, one doesn't really like to break the flow, Honourable Hill. Is it essential?
I can ask it later, it's fine.
Thank you.
So, the existing debt review process could be adopted to cater for this process, and the expenses could be included in the process like we have at the moment. And the consumer could sign an application form up front which sets out the process and conditions, and the non-payment of the installments would end the process for the consumer. So we believe that this process should be open to all consumers. The eligibility should be determined by the sole rules of DCRS Plus. And the solve period, I think we need to research that. The time was not enough to actually do that research. And but what we do want to say is that the increased payment by consumers will reduce it to the point where the good behavior discount will be reached much, much sooner. And I think that incentive in its own will actually benefit the consumers and will entice them to actually stick to the program. The suspension and enforcement of enforcement will be required. We need to clarify the position of secured debt in that situation because you don't always want the consumer to sit with a house where they're not paying sufficient money. We're aware that many local authorities already offer some sort of discount process. Maybe one can combine this with this proposal. And the out-of-court debt relief process can use the existing debt review framework and systems, and I think there's no need for a court order, will expedite the process and reduce the cost of the process. I think the impact on consumers is that it will be easy to understand, it will be easy to explain to consumers. The process can be modelled to be fair to all parties. The consumer behaviour will determine the reward that's offered at the end of the process, and they, if they increase their payments, which often they can, they will actually get back into the economy much, much sooner. The credit providers will know the debt relief contribution up front, and they will have to negotiate that. And the out-of-court process will speed up the process and reduce cost, but also provide debt review of this process a little bit more affordable to the poor as well. Out-of-court process could be speedy, cost-effective, and a market-friendly method to provide debt relief to all. Madam Chair, trying to summarise, is that we're saying that if we implement a process, I think what is very important is that when consumers apply for debt review, they need to get a budget to live by. The first 2 months is very, very difficult for those consumers, but we see very often that they actually get used to that process and they actually adopt to that process. I think that's very important. It will reduce the cost of collection and increase the collection rate. I think debt review has proved that. The collection rate is very, very high on debt review. And it will have a positive impact on the cost of credit overall. And it will assist with the payment of non-NCA debt, which I don't think we have a solution for at the moment, and reducing consumer debt will have a positive impact on the consumer spending and economic stimulus going forward. So in conclusion, what we're trying to propose is saying debt review is very important. DCRS, we have to make that work. But if somebody doesn't qualify for DCRS, what do we do then? And that's where we're saying maybe there's a secondary process where we actually introduce something that's balanced and also ties in with the consumer behavior to actually pay on a regular basis. The process is easy to explain to the consumer because of the benefit at the end, and the additional help is afforded to consumers who are severely debt-stressed and might not be able to make use of the benefits offered in the normal debt review process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Slott. And now I'm going to start off with Honourable Hill Lewis first. He asked for a clarification. Then we'll follow that by yourself, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Albert, Honourable Ranskalp. No, you haven't got your hand up this time. Those are the only three. Thank you.
Mr. Slott, thank you for an excellent presentation. It's one of the presentations that has provided a real concrete plan for how we can provide additional debt relief through the debt review process. And so thank you. I'll take this presentation very seriously, and I'm sure we'll call on you again. A couple of questions. Firstly, can you just outline exactly how what you have proposed can benefit low-income working class consumers? Because the message we often hear from debt counsellors is that they cannot take on those clients because it's a loss-making enterprise. And so we have to find a way that they can be included in the system. Then you said that, you know, people enter debt review and then they can't resist the SMS that they get offering them a new loan for this. Now, I mean, that is in blatant contravention of the assessment guidelines. So how is it that they are still getting credit under debt review? Yeah, I might have some others, but that's all for now.
You'll lose? Right, Honourable Mkong.
Yeah, Chairperson, I just want to join Honourable Lewis in welcoming the presentation. You know, according to the World Bank, of nearly 100 banking or financial crises that have occurred globally during the last 20 years, all were resolved by bailouts at taxpayers' expense. And no one wants to deal with that. When we talk about debt relief of the people, it becomes a problem. 100, in 20 years, 100 financial or banking crises have been paid through the taxpayer expense. Now the taxpayer is in trouble. And the excuses of not intervening in the crisis of taxpayers that have bailed out banks in the past 20 years. So this is a relationship problem of the rich and the poor. And we need to deal with that. Because the credit providers, they argue about the moral hazard. But they do not argue about the moral hazard. Because the issue of information asymmetry is a problem here between a credit provider and the borrower. And the credit provider does not take responsibility about that particular issue. So I think we need to deal with that. There are examples. Examples that we took laws here and made policies about business rescue. Everyone that is in business was happy that government is going to rescue them, but they are unable to rescue other people in the Republic of South Africa that are in the problem of debt. Their excuses. So it's very important what I've raised when we started, that we need a pact as South Africa to bail out the taxpayer who is in the financial crisis today. Because the very same taxpayer is the one that has bailed out the capital, especially the financial capital. But now the financial capital or monopoly capital is unable now to save the working class. That was saying that it is in trouble. So this is what we're trying to talk about. Thank you very much, Abizina.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mkongi. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question to each of the gentlemen. First to Mr. Willemse of the LNBLA. He's mentioned something that's quite interesting, the bad debt write-offs. Do we have any idea on what the scale of those write-offs would be for your organization annually? And perhaps you might have other statistics at large for all lenders in the country. We just get an idea how many people are being given a debt relief annually by the industry itself. Then to Mr. Slot from the CASA, you have a very interesting system here. I wasn't aware of this. How do you make people aware that there is a system called the DCRS and that they can make use of that? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert. I have just a couple of pointers myself. I must say I was not aware of your organisation, Mr. Valenza, until recently. And how long have you been going? And you can just give us that, because I don't see it here at all. What you have indicated in your presentation is that the legislation left a lot of gaps, many gaps, and problems which had to be resolved through industry task teams. Now, you alluded to one or two, but it would be very useful. It sounds like you have got a list of these somewhere, and that would be very useful if we could get that. It'll assist us, because at this stage, we're not, of course, looking at the whole legislation. Let me say this right now. Nevertheless, this does have to be done. You know, we do review this regularly, and that would certainly have to be taken into account. So I would, you know, we would appreciate that as a committee. The other issue is the point you list as more regulation, etc., etc., and should there be this and that and the next thing, and I mean, both of you have raised the in duplum. I will be asking Advocate van der Merwe, you know, we have new members in the committee to just explain that when I'm finished speaking. And then the impact on credit providers. You said debt relief must not have the effect of causing additional losses for credit providers. I think I've emphasized this point already. Losses have also been incurred from borrowers who are, in many instances, paying interests and this interest and insurance, etc., which are not really warranted. And very often, those who provide such insurance linked to goods and provide the finance actually don't pick up the phone and say, are you aware, I don't know if someone passed away in the family, but are you aware if someone did? They've never had such a call. So, you know, there needs to be, as far as I'm concerned, if you want something fair, there needs to be responsible lending as well, and I'm sure you're not opposed to that. And I was glad that when you spoke about the amnesty, you were not, of course that was your colleague, not referring to what has been referred to in the media as the initial debt forgiveness. There's never been a debt forgiveness for the workers, etc. There's been a moratorium on the debt owing, but purely a moratorium. And no, they would still have to have paid it back. So having said that, I do want to thank the debt councillors for a very detailed and targeted presentation. Thank you very much. And that's Mr. Slot. But just over initially to Advocate van der Merwe on the Induplum.
Thank you, Chairperson, and apologies to the members for addressing you from behind. I did not think I was going to speak today. The Induplum Room rule, if I can put it, I'll try and put it very simply. It means that you will have a capital amount that where there's interest on incurring on this amount. Let's say that amount of the debt is 100 rand and the interest is 1 rand per month. After 100 months, your interest is 100 rand. Now, if you have at some point stopped repayment, because your repayment will maybe be 10 rand, so that 9 rand covers debt and 1 rand covers interest. So you will never, the interest should never catch up to the amount of the debt. But if a person falls into arrears, you might find that there's no maybe a little bit of a frivolous example, but after these 100 months, now suddenly the debt and the interest is exactly the same amount. So in fact now the interest starts exceeding the amount of the debt, and that is where the Induplum rule comes in. So it stops that interest from increasing over and above the amount of the debt. I hope that, so in fact I quickly try to just on the computer make sure that maybe I get some more information. And what they say is Induplum, if you translate it, it means to double the amount. So that is just where it stops it, so that the person doesn't find him or herself in a situation where you start then, you can never catch up, in other words. So it stops the interest when it reaches the amount of the debt.
Very much. And now for our responses. I'm not sure who's going. Thank you, Mr. Willem, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I think just on the first observation about the need for a PAT, I think we all agree that the poor must be assisted, so they're over indebted, but I think we disagree on the mechanism. And as I stated, we believe that the way that it should be done is through debt counselling, and that the shortcomings of debt counselling need to be addressed. Yes, I'm sure we can put together a list of those gaps. I think Mr. Slot is probably the better person to assist me in that. But I think, you know, the simple thing that somebody's too poor to be able to apply for debt counselling, of course, is a concern. So I think that's where the intervention is required. And then I think there's also an issue around persistency, having the person to continue to be part of the program. So, and I haven't got a mandate to say that, but I'll say that in my personal capacity, I would welcome the kind of proposals that Mr. Slot has made, because I do believe that it will address the problem, you know, in specific terms rather than with a broad brush, which is what the legislative approach would do. Just on the issue of credit life, yes, it is in our interest as credit providers to inform the consumer. In fact, in most cases we handle that for him, because if there's a payout under a credit life insurance, that takes away the debt for us. So it is part of our procedures when somebody defaults to find out whether there is some cause that gives rise to a credit life claim, and then we assist the consumer to submit that claim. Just as far as the organization is concerned, we've been around for some 5 odd years. We came about as a result of a need which we perceived. We couldn't really be part of BASA because we are all non-banks. We also felt that the MFSA at that stage was dealing with the client base, or the member base was more smaller organizations which needed a different kind of assistance from an organization. So our organization is not, we don't have an infrastructure, we don't have employees, we don't have a bank account, we don't have a telephone number. We operate as a forum where the individual members get together and make input into legislation. And we've made substantial, over the years, we've made substantial submissions to DTI, to Treasury, and also to the NCR, the gauge of the NCR as well. So in essence, we've tried not to be too high, have too high a profile. We keep to ourselves, and we only write a submission when we really feel there's a need for it. So that's been our approach, and we think we've made valuable contributions over the period. We don't think people always listen to us, but I think that's just part of the process. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first question is in terms of low-income individuals. I think it is true that the very low-income earners find it very difficult to apply for debt tribute. The fee structure could accommodate it, but the problem always is who pays the legal fees. If you have to take a low-income earner to court, the cost of going to court is exactly the same. The proposal that we propose here is that if there's an out-of-court settlement agreement, it could actually save some cost and could bring that low cost individually. The other problem that we have with low-income earners is very often they married in community property, and the spouse needs to sign the affidavit as well. And it's almost impossible to get that. So that's the issue around low-income income earners. I think they could be accommodated in the program here, where we have an out-of-court settlement. It's easier to process, and there's a reduced cost in terms of the legal side of it. The second question, I think maybe I didn't express myself correctly, is maybe pre-debt tribute. You assist a consumer, where we do assist a consumer very often, to say, do the following changes to your budget and you can get out of debt, and without going into debt tribute, and only to learn the next day that they've applied for more debt. So you have to regulate that. The third issue, I think what we proposed here is that in DCRS and in debt review, I think the credit providers are making substantial concessions in terms of interest rates and fees, and I think we can take that further to actually make them part of the solution, and in effect they're paying for the solution as well. DCRS, how are we making that known to the public? I think the debt counsellors countrywide have been trained in it. It's always the first option that is tested for in any debt review. The changes and enhancements to the system will make it easier for debt counsellors to do that. So you have a debt counselling system that will calculate the repayments. And if it's solved under DCRS, that's the first option that will be considered for that consumer. We have a training document. If you want to have access to that training document, we will send you a copy of that as well. The last issue that was raised is the task team list, or the issues to address that is not legislated or not part of the National Credit Act. I must say that without the support of the NCR in creating a forum where we can discuss these issues that is not covered in the Act, debt counselling would not have been where it was, and maybe we should do more in that committee. I think we're probably going a little bit slow at the moment. I think we can actually do a little bit more in that committee to identify and get consensus on issues and having a little bit more pressure on us to actually make those issues work. But without the CIF and the task team agreement that went before that, I don't think we would have been where we are. And that's only through the goodwill of the industry, every player that's in the industry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Just closing off then, Mr. Willemsen.
Chair, sorry, apologies. I didn't answer Mr. Albert's question. I was trying to get information on the actual write-offs before today, but unfortunately I couldn't get it. But as a very broad indicator, you know, if I can put it this way, for every 100 rand of income that a credit provider receives, about 20 rand of that actually goes towards bad debt. So it's a substantial portion of your income which is into that, and I stand in correction, but that's the figure that's been given to me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Hill Lewis.
I asked those guys to stop. I don't know why they're carrying on, Chair. But I just wanted to say the one point that I disagreed with both of your presentations is you said it's very difficult to prove recklessness. I don't think that that's true. I think if you read the Act, it's very easy to prove recklessness. It's a simple question. was the person, or could the person have been over indebted at the time that, they received the credit agreement? The problem is it's so difficult to get the credit agreement actually declared reckless. It takes far too long. And that is partly why we are seeking to address that with the NCR, with some amendments to beef up their powers. And again, I want to stress that that will allow the NCR to affect so much more debt relief, because the Act provides already that if a agreement is declared reckless, that the consumer's obligations in terms of that agreement are null and void.
Right. No, I'm not going to extend this. There's still other matters to carry on with. That was addressed to yourself, though, Mr. Slot, wasn't it? Was it Mr. Slot? Oh, to both. I'd like you to take a minute each.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's an important issue that's been raised here. To prove reckless is not difficult. We've done hundreds of those. That's not the issue. I think the two issues here is that it's a very long process, a very costly process. Debt counsellors are required to do that with no income. That's why you're not seeing the reckless credit investigations concluded. So what is happening now, where the NCR will have the power to declare them reckless, much easier for the debt counsellor to do that.
Chair, just one point. I think that until we really get to a point where we have live information, you will always have room for debate. And you always have an excuse for a credit provider to say, I didn't see that on the credit bureau at the time when I was granting this loan. So I think, you know, if it's another initiative that I think we should take seriously, to actually have live credit bureau information.
Now, look, this clearly there's a lot more to engage on. But I know that the Honourable Williams and the subcommittee in which the Honourable Hill Lewis sits will, of course, go in. They do have more time. So everyone sitting here should be aware of that. I should also add that some of you did not sign the register going round, and that is why we only have the Standard Bank and First National Bank there. Is there anyone here from any other bank?
We have signed
it. Have you now signed it? Right. Okay, we must have that record, and if we can have it returned. I was under the impression there were five big banks, but they may have shrunk. Let's just get on with the program. I'd like to thank the stakeholders, including yourself, Mr. Willemser, Mr. Slot, for being here this morning. And I also want to appeal to the banks. We ourselves are facing changes in the program which we received today, and it is important to address this issue. And therefore, the request that has been made for the banks on Thursday. We do not have the luxury of meeting next Tuesday because of other parliamentary work that has been scheduled, etc. So I hope many of you appreciate the challenges we are all facing. But with respect to the program then, I think it's important to make it clear, Tuesday, you must know by now, there won't be a meeting next Tuesday, all right? Nor this Friday. So not a meeting this Friday, not a meeting next Tuesday. However, we have applied for, and I have no doubt we will get it, because I can't see anyone coming on Saturday. Can I see a hand raised who wants to meet on Saturday? No. So I have no doubt Thursday will be granted the time we have requested. I hope everyone is listening. That is this Thursday we're talking about. Am I right? And then the next one we're having then is the change is the Friday. Up until now, we've really tried to keep, when we do meet Fridays, short. And we haven't met every Friday, and you all know that. But on Friday the 25th, we don't have a choice. We are meeting 8:30 until 1500. Please diarise that. And then on Friday the 2nd, this is when we will get our formal consideration of a report on a memorandum. And it is that memorandum which, having been informed by the subcommittee recommendations, will move towards asking for measures, submission of legislative proposals regarding debt relief. It may request a bill, but at this stage it would be far too early for me to make that statement, really, because we are relying on the subcommittee to come to us with recommendations in this regard. I hope that is clear even to members. So that is Friday the 2nd. Friday the 2nd, meeting from 8 until 11. And then we'll all be able to go on constituency, and I'm sure many of you will work. But there is a meeting scheduled the following Tuesday the 6th. At that meeting, it is not on the program, but we have no choice but to look at the oversight we may take, the external oversight, and you are going to come to us with some suggestions and proposals. We will also be ensuring you get a reconciliation of your attendance in November and handing that off. And the budget we don't have to look at, so we won't be looking at that. We will also know from Ms. Naidu whether or not the performers bill, you know, a sort of intellectual property bill, will be before the committee early next year. It has been with the law advisors, I believe the state legal department, for 3 months now. So we can't expedite that process, am I right? And Mr. Herman, can you add anything you wish to add at this point before we adjourn? Is there any challenge a committee member is facing? Honourable Hill Lewis?
Please repeat the times for Thursday.
We are looking at 3 o'clock. Till 6, is it?
Thursday.
That is this Thursday. Honourable Mkongi?
Chair, can I just ask, just
question or comment?
On principle, you know, frankly, the order paper for Thursday sitting is a lot more important than the joint sitting. Can we not have permission to miss the joint sitting? Why not?
I really don't want to speak on behalf of the National Assembly Speaker or the chairperson of the NCOP. Perhaps your respective whips can. Honourable Mkongi?
I don't know, Chairperson, unless the chief whip is going to give me a permission. There's a by-election that is set in my constituency in George. And on Thursday, we are meeting the community for a nomination of our candidate. And I promised my region there that I will be there and witness when the community put an ANC candidate. So I'm not sure whether to put the apology to the chief whip or to you.
Can I simply remind you, Honourable Mkongi, you will apply for leave. Thank you. Yeah, on that pleasant note, the meeting is adjourned until tomorrow, until Thursday. Please don't forget the subcommittee tomorrow. Thank you.
No, I think it's just a test for a person to keep going to talk to you. We want to talk to you because you didn't change your mind. I thought I'd be back here. But I'm supposed to be here.
Thank you.